This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Demon Next Door, written by Brian Burrow, performed by Steve White. This title contains mature themes, including physical and sexual violence, that some listeners may find unsettling.
He was 2 years ahead of me at my high school. Yet, until recently, I had never heard of Danny Corwin, nor had many of our former schoolmates I reached out to, even though he had attacked a girl I knew at our junior high school, then nearly killed another in 10th grade before he started his murder spree as an adult, killing all the others. A close family friend, it turned out, had been his defense attorney, another his sentencing judge. Still another gave him work after prison. Our town, Temple, Texas, had barely 32,000 people in those days. How on earth had I known none of this? As I began asking questions, I started to realize my hometown was harboring a dark secret. I discovered the local Presbyterian church had been involved, as well as the mayor and the newspaper publisher. Secrets had piled atop secrets, and I began to wonder whether, in keeping them all, my hometown had unwittingly enabled a monster. "This is a story that needs to be told," insists Bob Odom, who prosecuted the teenage Danny. "That kid was a time bomb, and we didn't know it. I don't think anyone really wanted to know. We could do a better job identifying these kinds of people." Easier said than done. In 2005, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, then headed by Robert Mueller III, sponsored a symposium in San Antonio, Texas, that brought together a group of experts on serial murder. One of their conclusions was especially relevant to the Danny Corwin case. The majority of serial killers are not reclusive social misfits who live alone. Many serial killers hide in plain sight within their communities. Serial murderers often have families and homes, are gainfully employed, and appear to be normal members of the community. Because many serial murderers can blend in so effortlessly, they are oftentimes overlooked by law enforcement and the public. My family had moved from Memphis to Waco, Texas in 1969, spending 3 years there before moving a half hour down Interstate 35 to Temple when I was 11. My father was the new president of the First National Bank. My mother, a housewife who busied herself with the Junior League. A year later, I entered Bonham Junior High, high on a hill above the interstate on Temple's far southwest side. Temple was, and still is, a sun-baked highway town known for its powerhouse high school football team, the Wildcats, and its two medical centers, Baylor's Scott and White and King's Daughters. All those doctors give Temple a white-collar patina that barely disguises its origins as a gritty hub for the Santa Fe Railway. At school, a ubiquitous item of clothing was a navy blue Future Farmers of America jacket. The people who passed for old money, whose families had been in town for decades, lived in roomy houses on the north side. The poorer neighborhoods clustered around downtown. If you were new, like us, you lived in the developments that were springing up on the southwestern edge of town, in hundreds of ranch houses. Even with so many new people moving in, I find it odd that I didn't know the Corwins, a close-knit family of six who lived in Western Hills, a new development across I-35 on the west side of town. The parents, Philip and Nancy, were originally from upstate New York. But when Phil had transferred among various factory management jobs, the family had lived a nomadic existence, moving to California, to Louisville, to Memphis, and 2 years before we did, to Temple. Both my family and the Corwins were Presbyterian, though we belonged to different churches, but we both sometimes vacationed at the Presbyterian Moe Ranch Resort out in the Texas Hill Country. Phil and Nan Corwin were far more devout than was anyone in my family. The couple had met in church, and by the time they joined First Presbyterian, their lives were defined by the easy rhythms of a Southern congregation's social activities, singing in the choir, chaperoning youth groups, cooking for potluck dinners. The Corwins lived in a ranch house on Deer Trail, a street of nearly identical homes. Of their four children, the oldest, Debbie, was a social butterfly, popular with both boys and girls. The two youngest children were Donna and David. The second child, Daniel Lee Corwin, was known as Danny. To those few in Temple today who recognize the name, it triggers vivid reactions. When I walked into the school district office by the high school to look at old yearbooks, the receptionist, Tammy Matthews, asked if I was looking for anyone in particular. "Danny Corwin," I said. She froze. "Danny Corwin? Oh, I get chill bumps when you mention that name," she said, running her hands up and down her arms. "We were in the same grade. Danny sat next to me in history. The one thing I remember clearly about him is he would sit there and clean his nails with a pocket knife." A chilling detail in light of what Danny did with knives when he got older. I first heard Danny's name from my girlfriend's daughter, who was taking a criminology class at Baylor University. To her surprise, her professor casually mentioned that a serial killer had lived in my hometown. I was no less shocked when she told me. Danny Corwin may not have been the most prolific serial killer in American history, but his story came to obsess me. It raises important issues about radical evil. What had driven Danny to rape and murder his victims so gruesomely? Could his psychosis have been predicted and prevented? Is rehabilitation possible for a violent psychopath? How can we ever know if it has worked? For me, there was an intimacy to the case that was horrifically powerful. When I was barely a teenager, I had brushed up against something unspeakably malevolent in a town I hardly knew. Most people, I believe, come to an age where they want to explore overlooked aspects of their youth. The saying runs, "You can't go home again," but given a second chance to know Danny Corwin and to discover why our town had buried this dark secret, I couldn't pass it up. I spoke with Danny's childhood friends and acquaintances who had attended his church, his teachers, and others who knew about or had somehow been involved in the case. Fortunately for me, a trove of Danny's police, court, prison, academic, and medical records is stored at the University of Texas. 25 years ago, a Texas true crime writer named Gary Laverne attempted to write a book about Danny's crimes. After amassing thousands of pages of documents, he decided against it. Gary, who now works as director of admissions research at the university, deposited his papers there, and he graciously acted as my guide to them. Danny Corwin was born in Garden Grove, California in 1958. It was a difficult birth. According to his father, the umbilical cord emerged before the rest of the baby. To prevent suffocation, doctors performed an emergency cesarean section. Unlike his siblings, who had dark complexions, Danny was blue-eyed and blonde. His hair, often styled in the awful bowl cut of the day, was so light it bleached white in the summer. Never much of a student, Danny was obliged to repeat third grade due to poor reading skills. His report cards were littered with C's, D's, and the occasional F. The Corwins' lives revolved around First Presbyterian, a squat, gray, north side building that housed one of the city's oldest congregations. The Corwin kids all grew up there. Danny mowed the lawn, Nan sang in the choir, Phil ran the Boy Scout troop. Together, Phil and Nan ran the youth group. "They were amazing with children," recalls Kathleen Person, now Temple's municipal judge who attended First Presbyterian. "I can't tell you how many Saturday nights we did a lock-in, and they were up all night with, like, 50 kids. We would crawl all over the church, and they were just wonderful." Back then, Danny was just another rambunctious boy. He enjoyed fishing, the Boy Scouts, and riding his bicycle. He loved to draw, cowboys and Indians, horses, African animals. He played a year of football at Bonham Junior High. We had a pool table in the church basement, and Danny and I would run out of Sunday school to get to it, a church friend of his told me. He taught me to play pool and ping pong. To me, he was an extremely normal guy. Around his parents, though, and later with other authority figures, a different Danny emerged, quiet, pliant, helpful, endlessly in need of adult affirmation. It was one reason that, throughout his life, so many adults liked him. He seemed forever willing to please. The first psychologists who examined Danny as a teenager were struck by how deeply dependent he was on his parents' approval, a trait shown vividly on a questionnaire that asked him to complete various statements. Given the words, "I feel," Danny finished the sentence with, "that I can never leave my parents." Given, "I am best when," Danny wrote, "I am with my parents." Given, "My greatest worry is," Danny wrote, "that my parents might die before I'm ready." Danny may appear the ideal adolescent since he is polite, cooperative, reliable, dependable, and does not resist authority, this doctor wrote. The downside, another added, was that he seemingly needs adult approval in order to function. Where doctors found signs of severe emotional underdevelopment, Phil and Nan Corwin saw an attentive son. When Danny's bedwetting, a sign of stress in children and adolescents, continued into his teens, they told themselves he was simply a sound sleeper. Growing up, Danny was a caring, loving boy who wanted to please, Phil told a reporter for the Houston Chronicle in 1990. He was not an Einstein, but he did all right in school. He loved the outdoors more than anything. If he'd been the type of boy always in fights, maybe it would be easier to accept. He wasn't one of those kids who ricochet off the walls. Younger children adored him. The Corwin and Exley families were close, and Becky Exley, 7 years Danny's junior, remembers idolizing him. She recalls balmy Sunday afternoons swimming at Lake Belton, sitting atop his shoulders chicken fighting with other kids. When their parents went square dancing, Danny was her favorite babysitter. It was with girls his own age that Danny could appear uncomfortable or uncommunicative. "He always scared me," recalls Cindy Volter, whose family attended First Presbyterian. "He would never look you in the eyes. He always walked kind of hunched over, just creepy. He wouldn't say hi to me, and we were around each other all the time. We all thought he was weird." There are stories about Danny and girls that would seem innocent if told of another child, but that can be viewed in a different light given what happened later. "I do remember one thing," recalls Ruth Hovell, now 89, who taught Sunday school at First Presbyterian for years. "I was teaching upstairs. There was a railing around the staircase. As I came out of class, an elderly woman, Mrs. Day, was saying, 'Oh, no, no, Danny.' What Danny was doing, he was holding one of the Shaw girls over that railing and threatening to drop her down the staircase, which would have hurt her badly. Mrs. Day stopped him. They were giggling and laughing. I thought it was a joke, but as time went on and all these other things happened, I wasn't so sure." Another thing that some friends note was Danny's occasional penchant for deception. "What I remember most was this camping trip we took to Camp Tawaya," says Bruce Smith, who belonged to Phil and Danny's Boy Scout troop and was later president of Danny's high school class. "Danny and I shared a tent. You had to bring a roll of coins for the Coke machine. I noticed my roll was gone. I found it in Danny's footlocker. I never said anything, but I locked everything up after that." At 12 and 13, Danny was interested in sex, but so are most boys that age. "When I first met him, I was like 7 or 8. He must have been like 13. He goes, 'Chuck, rhymes with fuck,' Chuck Volter, a Western Hills neighbor of the Corwins, told me. He seemed to be really happy to clue me in to all the particulars. Danny always seemed strange to me. Awkward, you know?" Not until years later would darker stories about Danny's childhood circulate. According to a close family friend, after Danny and his older sister got into a spat, he killed her cat, and gossip spread that Danny was seen peering into the windows of neighborhood girls' bedrooms at night. The stories were never verified, but wouldn't be surprising. Many rapists begin as peeping Toms. The most tantalizing suggestion of deviancy would come from a psychologist who examined Danny much later in life. According to this doctor, in an assertion not to be found in any criminal or court reports, from an early age, Danny had been having sex with animals. On a Friday, March 15, 1974, the Raymond Finn family, who lived in the house next door to the Corwins, asked an eighth grader named Kathy Choate to babysit their infant son. Kathy, whose family was also new in town, was a year ahead of me at Bonham. 4 days short of turning 14, she was pretty and already popular. We had several mutual friends. When the Finns headed out for a movie, Kathy took the baby into the front yard and rolled a ball with him. When it got dark, around 8, she went inside, put the baby to bed, turned on the television, and began watching a movie. 2 hours later, she heard a noise outside a sliding door in the next room. Checking, she saw it was open about a foot. She closed and locked it, then went back to the movie. An hour after that, around 11, she heard the baby cry. She got up and stepped down the darkened hallway to the baby's room. As she passed the master bedroom, a naked teenager jumped from the darkness, clamped his arm around her throat, and hissed, "If you scream, I'll kill you." He had a knife. He pushed her into the bedroom and ordered her to take off her clothes. She couldn't make out his face. The only illumination was from the moonlight streaming in from a window. As she disrobed, he cut off a piece of her t-shirt and gagged her with it. He then pushed her onto the bed and raped her. "I was screaming, and he kept telling me to shut up," Kathy testified at a trial almost 20 years later. "I would try to talk to him and try to keep him from being too mad at me. I would try to talk to him, and then I would scream some more. Then I would talk to him, and I would scream some more." When he was finished, Kathy snatched up her clothes, ran into a bathroom, and locked the door behind her. A few seconds later came a soft knock. She braced herself, unsure what to do. Finally, realizing he could force the door open, she opened it. That's when she saw his face. "You have my shirt," he said. In her haste, she had picked up his clothes as well as her own. Kathy handed him his t-shirt. "I'm sorry," she said. "I live across town," he said before leaving the house, "and you don't know me." The Finns arrived home shortly after. We found the babysitter. She was hysterical and had locked herself in the bathroom, Gretchen Finn remembers today. The police arrived quickly. Kathy told the officers she couldn't be sure who had raped her, but she thought it might be a kid from another school she knew named Speedy. Raymond Finn had his own ideas. From Kathy's description, the rapist sounded like their next-door neighbor's eldest son, Danny Corwin. A week later, a Temple police officer appeared at the Corwin home and interviewed Danny in the presence of his father. Danny denied everything, but acknowledged he and his siblings had been home alone that Friday night. When the officer asked if he'd be willing to take a polygraph, Phil Corwin said yes. The next morning, Kathy Choate called police and told them she had seen her rapist at school. It wasn't Speedy, as police had already decided. It was Danny. A few days later, an officer drove Danny and his father to Austin, where a state examiner administered 3 polygraph tests. All 3 were judged inconclusive. The examiner said he couldn't tell if Danny was guilty or not. In the following days, police interviewed Danny's siblings and neighbors. None shed any light on the case. In the end, police told Kathy and her father there wasn't enough evidence to arrest Danny, especially given Kathy's initial identification of Speedy. There was nothing they could do. The rape never made the newspapers. It remained a secret. The Corwins tried to forget the entire incident, telling themselves it was all some kind of crazy misunderstanding. It was easy to do so, given the difficulties the family was encountering around that time. Phil had left his job to start a company making fiberglass boats. That July, it failed. Unable to afford their mortgage payment, the family moved to a vacant lot in Moffett, 8 miles outside Temple, where the parents bunked in a mobile home and the children slept in a tent. Still, the parents recalled this period as a happy one. They played board games at night. The children, including Danny, enrolled at schools in neighboring Belton. Sometimes, Nan Corwin told them, things like this happen. That winter, a church friend arranged for Phil to get a job in maintenance at King's Daughters Hospital. In January 1975, Danny returned to the Temple Schools, enrolling as a 10th grader. Somehow, in the transitions among schools, Danny lost whatever friends he had. In later years, he would say he didn't fit in at Temple High. He felt rejected socially. "He was in my study hall," recalls Jim Huggins, today a retired Texas Ranger. "What little I remember of him was he was kind of an outcast. I never saw anyone socialize with him. He was just one of those guys. You see him and you just forget him." On Friday, May 16, 1975, just before the end of the school year, the Corwins were preparing to leave on a weekend trip with the church youth group. All four kids were going. Phil and Nan were among the chaperones. Nan wrote a note to Temple High asking permission for Danny to leave school early, at noon. He left on time, promising to meet his father later that day. Almost 2 hours later, a 10th grader named Brenda Evans appeared at the office and received a pass of her own. That afternoon, Brenda needed to leave school to pick up a friend's child for a class on babysitting. After taking her pass, she pushed through the school's glass front doors, walked down the steps and into the parking lot, which filled the space between the school and the mammoth 10,000-seat Wildcat Stadium. When she reached her car, she saw Danny sitting on a car beside it. She knew him. They had been at Bonham together. "Hi, Daniel. What you doing?" she said. "Not much." Brenda slid into her driver's seat, closed the door, and reached down to get an 8-track tape. Behind her, the door reopened. It was Danny. He raised a knife to her face. "Move over. Let me in," he said. She didn't understand. She laughed. "You're kidding," she said. "Damn it," he said. "I said move over. Let me in." Danny said move over and let's go two or three more times. And finally, Brenda moved into the passenger seat. Danny started the car, backed out of the parking space, and wheeled out of the lot like crazy, Brenda said years later. As Brenda continued asking him what he wanted, Danny turned right, zooming north up 31st Street, past the skating rink and a series of open fields, then followed the street to the left where it crossed Interstate 35. On the far side of the highway was pasture land dotted with a smattering of mobile homes. Danny took the first right onto Eberhardt Road into an area Temple kids called Derby Hill, where teenage boys ran soapbox derbies. There he turned into an old gravel pit, stopping the car beside an abandoned shack. They were a mile and a half from the high school. Turning off the car, Danny once again raised his knife to Brenda's face. "Take your clothes off," he told her. "Daniel, what's wrong with you?" she asked. "Shut up, damn it, just take them off." When she still wouldn't, Danny forced her onto her back and crawled on top of her. "If you don't take your clothes off, I'll rip them off," he said. "Okay," she finally said. "If you'll get out, I will." Once Danny stepped out of the car, he reached back through the window and tore off Brenda's blouse. She began to scream. He reacted by tearing off her bra. As she continued to scream, Danny grabbed her and pulled off first her blue jeans, then her panties, and tossed both into a mud puddle. Quickly doffing his own jeans, Danny reached in and tried to put his hand across Brenda's mouth, but she began thrashing furiously. He grabbed her by the hair, then forced her down on the seat. Even as Brenda struggled, Danny climbed on top of her and raped her. By the time he finished, Brenda had gained her senses and began speaking to him in a calmer voice, attempting to reason with him. She was beginning to suspect he had something in mind worse than rape. "I'll give you my car, and I won't tell the police anything," she said, "if you'll just leave me alive." Danny said nothing. After a moment, he got off her, stepped from the car, and put his clothes back on. "Get out," he said. "No," Brenda replied. "I want my clothes first." "You won't need them," he said. When Brenda still refused to move, he reached in and grabbed her arm. She reacted by kicking him hard in the crotch. He winced and cursed, then snatched up her clothes and tossed them to her. Once she dressed, Danny jerked her from the car and, still brandishing the knife, told her to walk to the back of the car. He ordered her into the trunk, but when he went to open it, he couldn't. "Is the damn thing broke?" he spat. "Oh," Brenda said. "Yeah, I forgot to tell you that." Danny looked around the gravel pit. Motioning to a pile of dirt, he said, "Go over there." Brenda took a few steps, then stopped and turned back toward him. Danny put his hand on her throat and forced her back toward the dirt pile. A brief struggle ensued. Danny put the knife to Brenda's throat. She tried to flip him over her shoulder. He pushed her to the ground. She landed on her back in the dirt. He quickly dropped onto her, straddling her midsection, his knees pinning her arms to the hard dirt. Then, without saying a word, Danny stabbed Brenda in the fleshy part of her upper right arm. Again, she began to scream. "Shut up!" Danny kept saying. "Shut up!" Helpless to move and bleeding from her wound, Brenda said, "Do you know what you're doing?" "Yeah," Danny said. "I know exactly what I'm doing." And then Danny brought his knife to Brenda's throat and, in one savage movement, sliced the blade all the way across. Blood gushed everywhere. As Brenda gasped for breath, she looked up into Danny's face. Danny was staring at her intently. "Daniel, I'm going to die," Brenda rasped. "Just leave me alone." She began to scream again. "Shut up," Danny said, and stabbed her in the stomach. Withdrawing the bloody blade, he pointed it at her heart. "No, Daniel," Brenda pleaded. "Not in my heart. Please, not in my heart." A weird smile crossed Danny's face. Then he placed the tip of the knife between the cups of Brenda's bra and, applying his weight, slowly drove it into her chest. After several moments, he once again withdrew the blade. As Brenda gaped in disbelief, Danny rose to his feet. She went still. For the longest time, maybe 2 full minutes, it seemed like an eternity, Danny just stood there, motionless, staring at Brenda as she bled. Finally, he reached down, grabbed an old board off the dirt pile and tossed it across Brenda's face. Next, he gathered several handfuls of dirt and mud and tossed them across her feet. Last, he brought some hay and weeds and covered the rest of her body. All the while, Brenda lay deathly still, hoping he would just go away. She couldn't see him now. The board blocked her view. But as she strained to listen, she heard him tossing things from her car. She heard him toss her purse to one side. Then she heard the engine start. The car began to move. And then, to her horror, it turned toward her. He was going to run her over. But he didn't. The tires passed barely 4 feet from Brenda's head. And then there was silence. He was gone. Brenda lay still for the longest time, certain Danny would return and finish her off. After several minutes, she pushed off the board and the weeds and managed, to her amazement, to stand. It was a miracle she was still alive. Only later would she realize what had saved her. When Danny drove the knife into her chest, her bra clasp had prevented it from sinking fully in. Half naked, covered with blood, Brenda staggered to the roadside. One car passed before a second one stopped. The driver took her to a Gulf station on the highway, where police were called. After hiding Brenda's car, Danny made his way back to the high school parking lot, where at 2:45, a girl named Janie Hart saw him. She drove him a few hundred yards up to 31st Street to the Dairy Queen for a soda. "We then came back to the high school," Hart later told police, "and I asked him what he had done all afternoon. He told me he had really done some strange things today." Danny said nothing else. Hart agreed to drive him to a Dr. Pepper dealership next door to Paul Boyd Ford, where Danny said he was to meet his father. On the way, they heard news of the rape on the car radio. Danny's name was not mentioned. This did not excite him, Janie Hart told police afterward. Within minutes, the Gulf station on I-35 was lined with police cars, lights flashing, and a pair of ambulances. Medics bandaged Brenda's wounds, and before taking her to Scott and White Hospital, allowed police to briefly question her. Brenda told them what happened and identified Danny as her attacker. Among the officers responding that day was Kenneth Miller, who had investigated Kathy Choate's rape a year earlier. Miller drove to the former Corwin home in Western Hills and, when no one answered the door, walked next door to the Finn home. When Gretchen Finn answered the door, Miller told her he was looking for Danny. "I can guess why," she said. Miller told her Danny was wanted for aggravated rape. "That's about right," Mrs. Finn replied. Told that Nan Corwin worked at Temple National Bank downtown, Miller drove there. He found her with her daughter, standing outside a second-floor office. They were leaving to meet Danny and his father at church. When Miller explained why he was looking for Danny, Nan volunteered to accompany him to Moffitt. Driving out Highway 36 toward Lake Belton, Miller turned on his rolling lights and picked up speed. Just as he reached the turn toward Moffitt, he noticed a brown station wagon that resembled the one the Corwins owned. Yes, Nan confirmed, it was theirs. She said her husband and daughter were inside, heading to meet the rest of the family at the church. But instead, Miller saw Danny behind the wheel. Turning around, he gave chase, telling Nan that if it really was her husband, they could talk to him. Ahead, the station wagon gained speed, heading toward Temple's small airport. Miller, turning on his siren, raced after it, reaching a speed of 90 miles an hour. As he neared the car, the driver refused to pull over. Miller accelerated once more, pulling up alongside it. Glancing over, he made eye contact with the driver. It was Danny. Miller surged forward once more, pulling in front of the station wagon, then slowed. Danny finally eased to the side of the road and stopped. Miller stepped out and pointed his gun at the car. Danny went peacefully, allowing Miller to handcuff him. At that point, Nan became distraught. His mother asked how he could have done this thing, Miller wrote in a subsequent report, and he told her to be quiet and not say anything. At the police station, Phil Corwin was waiting. According to Miller's report, he shouted, "Danny, don't say a word about anything." With his mother looking on, Danny was booked and taken to the Bell County Jail. In the meantime, other officers found Brenda's car parked behind the Temple auction barn and located the crime scene in the gravel pit off Eberhardt Road. They found fresh tire marks and Brenda's purse lying in the dirt. Public reaction to the attack was, at best, muted. In part because Danny and Brenda were minors, news of what happened was limited to a single article on an inside page of the Temple Daily Telegram. It left out the lurid details. Most people heard about those only by word of mouth. The week after, Danny's friend Brian Smith and members of the football team, a cohesive group that took pride in protecting the school, stood in circles in the student center every morning, trying to understand it all. There was a discussion in the group. "How could we have let this happen?" Smith remembers. "We would never suspect this could happen, much less suspect it could happen to our friends. It was kind of, I don't know, why didn't we stop it?" Danny was freed on a $10,000 bond after 30 days in jail. For the Corwins and their friends, who couldn't fathom that Danny was capable of something like this, the reaction was that it was all some kind of bizarre mix-up. "I remember the day he got out," recalls Becky Exley. "At church, he was standing at the glass doors wearing a striped shirt, blue with red stripes. I remember jumping out of our Volvo and running to him and hugging him. When I asked whether she had asked Danny about what happened that day with Brenda, Becky looked at me with surprise. You don't understand. To us, it didn't happen, she says. I never asked. He couldn't talk about it, because it didn't happen. There was an odd footnote to Danny's jail stay. According to Danny, while staying in the Bell County Jail, he was raped by another prisoner. He mentioned it to a prison psychologist, but it's not clear he ever described it in detail or that it actually happened. Temple was changing in those days. Northerners were pouring into Texas, and during and after the Vietnam War, many who passed through the Army's gargantuan Fort Hood, 20 miles west in Killeen, liked the low taxes and warm weather enough to make Central Texas a permanent home. Temple's population leaped 27% during the 1970s. If the local legal system wasn't overwhelmed by the influx, it was struggling to keep up. At 30, Bell County's district attorney, Joe Carroll, was the youngest district attorney in Texas when he took office 2 years earlier in January 1973. He supervised cases in three counties, including Bell, on a salary of barely $1,000 a month, so little that some of his similarly compensated peers kept a hand in private practice. When this case came up, we were real busy and understaffed, remembers Carroll, today a kindly retired judge. From the outset, it was clear that Danny's would be no ordinary case. It was not only an unusually violent crime, it would draw in some of Bell County's most powerful citizens, including Brenda's father, Reginald Evans, who served as the chairman and the dominant force of Temple's school board during much of the 1960s. A man accustomed to getting his way, Evans wanted justice. He wanted it quickly, and he had no qualms making that loud and clear to prosecutors. Reginald Evans was a large man with a booming bass voice, Joe Carroll told me. When he talked, you listened, because if he didn't, you drowned. Surprisingly, the Corwins, though relative newcomers to Temple, were able to draw on powerful friends of their own, thanks to their deep involvement with First Presbyterian. The church was the spiritual home of Temple's two most influential citizens, the popular outgoing mayor, Jamie Clements, and the man who controlled the town's media for more than 50 years, Frank Mayborn, the owner of the Temple Daily Telegram, the town's main radio station, and 20 minutes up I-35, the nearest television station, KCEN-TV. When the Corwins sought guidance from their minister, Wilson Keenan, he promised to help in any way he could. In search of allies with influence, Keenan turned to Clements and Mayborn. Frank and Jamie and Wilson Keenan spent lots and lots of time on this, meeting secretly at the church, says Mary Ann Gibson, a Temple realtor who became a church deacon. Because it was the one place they could meet that wasn't public. They came in through the back door to Wilson's office, and no one would even know they were there. I remember they ate Clem McKeska's barbecue, and it was all about this, how to handle Danny's arrest. It badly divided First Presbyterian. On one side were those led by Mayor Clements who respected the Corwins but still felt Danny had no place in the church, at least until his case was resolved. He came to services that whole time, recalls the mayor's daughter Cindy. My dad was like, how the hell can he be in church? This is not right for him to be around our children. His sister Debbie used to carpool me everywhere. When Danny came back from jail, Dad stopped that. It was a controversy, recalls Kathleen Person, the judge whose family attended First Presbyterian. Some people didn't think having Danny around was an appropriate thing. The church was deeply divided, recalls Jerry Sechrist, the young Temple lawyer the Corwins hired to represent Danny. The preacher was trying to raise money for my fee, and he didn't get much, and a good number of people were opposed even to that. On the other side were families who felt that whatever Danny had done, the family deserved the congregation's support. There were people who thought the Corwins should be shunned and asked to leave the church, and there was a group of us who, as Christians, were against that, recalls Ruth Hovel, the Sunday school teacher. Certainly for me, we had to examine our own consciences and decide, what does the word Christian really mean? How should we respond to this? I felt like they were faithful members of the church. They were there every Sunday, and the church needed to help them. Even though he did these terrible things, the family was hurting and needed our support and love. It was a test for us, a test to our Christian community. In this group were many who believed either that Danny was a confused teenager in need of counseling, or that Brenda had, somehow, lured him into a fraught situation. Dark gossip about Brenda was able to spread in large part because details of the crime, including the slashing of her neck, were not publicly disclosed. Into the vacuum crept all manner of sordid rumors about Brenda's reputation. At church? Yeah, they said she was a whore, says Becky Exley. Everyone said it. What you heard at the church was she was a little bit of a wild chick, says Marianne Gibson, the church deacon. Whatever transpired, people were saying she was not blameless. I do remember that. And that caused a lot of division in the church and in the town because Reginald Evans had lots of friends, lots of them, and many at the church. In the end, Reverend Keenan felt compelled to act. There was no way Danny could have done this, he believed. And if something really had happened, then Danny needed professional help, not prison time. Somehow, they had to save him. Danny's case was assigned to a felony prosecutor named Bob Odom. Today, after a long career in private practice, Odom is back in the DA's office handling criminal appeals. A gruff, straightforward man in his 70s, he meets me in his office at the Bell County Justice Complex. He recalls Danny's case vividly, not only because of its horrific circumstances, but because of strident attempts by a number of people, including some in his own office, to block Danny's prosecution. "To be honest, we got a lot of pressure," Odom recalls. "I'd tried numerous sexual assault cases. This was the most pressure I ever received. A number of citizens contacted our office and just wouldn't believe Danny would do this. They either believed he didn't do it or she had asked for it. We actually had a staff member who knew the family. He kind of led the charge. That's very unusual. Very, very unusual." Opposing Odom was Danny's lawyer, Sechrist, a straight-arrow former FBI agent. He had been one of the Corwin's neighbors in Western Hills. Based on Brenda's statements, Sechrist knew he had little chance of winning the case. Danny, who was sullen and monosyllabic in their meetings, seemed wholly incapable of defending himself on the witness stand. "Would I let him testify? Oh, God, no," Sechrist says. "He could barely talk to you. He wasn't conversational. He mowed my lawn, but I bet he never said 10 words to me." Sechrist's plight was underscored when he had Danny take a polygraph test up the interstate in Waco. Danny actually passed the test. But when the polygraph operator, a savvy, skeptical former Texas Ranger in an apparent second effort to determine what actually happened, told him he had failed, Danny blurted out the truth. Both Sechrist and the operator were flabbergasted. Sechrist, in fact, like Bob Odom, believed Danny faced not only a slam-dunk conviction, but a slam-dunk life sentence. "No juror would have given him less than a life sentence," Odom tells me. And Sechrist agrees. "Oh, definitely. If Danny had gone to a jury, he would have gotten life, no doubt." But this didn't happen, due in large part to the intervention of the First Presbyterian Church. Bob Odom clearly remembers Reverend Keenan and a delegation of church elders appearing in his office on the square in Belton. "I had started picking up rumors a little about something going on in the church, but I didn't know how intense it was," Odom remembers. "They came in out of the blue. I don't remember whether they called and set up an appointment or what. I remember the reverend did most of the talking. First of all, they were wanting a dismissal, a complete dismissal. I made clear that would not happen. I said, no way, the kid slit her throat." Reverend Keenan had a fallback position. "Yeah," Odom goes on, "then they wanted probation. Maybe, Keenan urged, Danny could enter some kind of juvenile treatment facility. Again, Odom refused. They kept saying this was a solid family, active in the church. They didn't know what he had done. I tried to be patient, but they got very frustrated. It got heated. It was then that the delegation from First Presbyterian disclosed its whole card. They were prepared, Reverend Keenan made clear, to paint an ugly picture of Brenda. They believed either the kid couldn't have done it, Odom said, or she had asked for it. Let's just say they were going to attack her reputation. Let's leave it at that. There were some extreme kinds of things said. Their evidence was, everybody knows it. Everybody knows she was loose, that kind of thing. It was offensive. Offensive, but not entirely surprising. In the 1970s, attacking a victim's reputation was standard in rape trials. It has since been outlawed in Texas. In cases where the evidence was strong, it was practically the only available defense. Back then, you kind of expected that, says Odom. But for it to come from a church? That was a little bizarre. He shakes his head. No, sir, I have never seen that before or since. In the end, Odom and the church delegation were talking past each other. They got very upset, Odom says. I just kept saying, no, I'm sorry. He cut her throat. I don't care if she's a streetwalker in Killeen. He cut her throat. I'm not offering probation. It was pretty tense when they left. The case dragged on for months after Sechrest appealed an early ruling that Danny could be tried as an adult. By early 1976, the court ruled that Danny could in fact be tried as an adult, and a trial loomed. Odom felt certain he had an ironclad case and confident he could get a life sentence. That is, if Brenda proved as warm and forthcoming on the witness stand as she had been in their private discussions. But from his meeting with First Presbyterian, Odom could tell things would get nasty. He had a duty to make that clear to Brenda and her father. I want to say I had them in on a Saturday and the trial started on Monday, Odom recalls. We went through all the facts. I told them I couldn't try the case without Brenda. This was before DNA. We had no physical evidence, no fingerprints. However, once Odom explained the brewing attack on Brenda's reputation, Reginald Evans's zeal for justice suddenly ebbed. The father did not want her to go through cross-examination, Odom says. He just didn't want to put her through that. After 30-odd years, everyone involved has a different memory of what happened next. But after speaking to many of those involved, here's what apparently occurred. Once her father refused to allow Brenda to testify, both sides wanted to avoid a trial. The DA feared he would lose without Brenda's testimony. Jerry Sechrest, still assuming Brenda would testify, believed she would send Danny off to a life in prison. At a standstill, the prosecutors blinked. They offered a plea deal. 30 years. In the Texas prison system, which meant Danny might serve 10 or 15 years at most, Sechrest couldn't believe his luck. They came to us with 30. We said, sure, he says. That's when things got complicated. The prosecutors couldn't ignore someone as powerful as Reginald Evans. According to Sechrest, they sought Evans's approval for the plea deal. He turned it down flat. That was the influence, Sechrest recalls. If Reginald Evans had been a plumber, that never would have happened. But he was school board president, so... At that point, Sechrest had only one option if he were to avoid a trial. He entered a guilty plea for Danny, then requested a hearing before a judge to determine punishment. By doing so, Sechrest felt he had a better chance of avoiding a prison sentence in favor of some kind of treatment. To support his argument, he had Danny assessed by two Austin psychiatrists, who produced a letter declaring that he suffered from latent schizophrenia and concluded Danny desperately needs psychiatric treatment. The hearing at the Bell County Courthouse stretched over 2 days in April 1976. The psychiatrists testified on Danny's behalf. The state's witnesses included those involved in the aftermath of the attack: police, medics, and doctors. But the star witness was Brenda herself. Because Danny had already pled guilty, Sechrist saw no reason to cross-examine her, because "I just wanted her off the stand as quickly as possible," he says. Bob Odom was able to walk her through the attack in detail. Brenda's testimony, nevertheless, made a powerful impression on the judge, Don Busby, one of my parents' friends. Busby couldn't ignore the savagery of the attack, but in his heart, he felt Danny did need help. "I had trepidation about the sentence," recalls Busby, today a businessman in Austin. "I did some research about how much influence I might have with the Department of Corrections to get him treatment. They assured me, yes, once an assessment is made, he will get it. It was a gut-wrenching deal, but one of those, you know, you have to pull the trigger and hope for the best." In the end, Busby sentenced Danny to 40 years. No one involved was entirely satisfied. The Corwins and their friends at the church were crushed. "It was a shock, yeah," says Becky Exley. "We thought he was going to Rusk, a juvenile facility, to get treatment." The prosecutors weren't thrilled either. "Knowing what I know now, do I regret letting him go with 40 years? "Yes, I do," says Odom. "It was a psychosexual thing, but we didn't have the knowledge to deal with that like we do now. Back then, you popped a guy, sent him away, and that was that. This guy was a time bomb, and we just didn't know it." After Danny was sent away, a strange thing happened. Temple forgot about him. Memory of the entire incident disappeared from the town's collective consciousness. Danny's sentencing drew one brief article in the Temple Daily Telegram. "I was almost 15 then, and had just been named editor of the Temple High School newspaper. I don't remember hearing a single word about any of this at the time, or for 40 years after. It's strange. Yeah, it did kind of get forgotten. It wasn't something anyone really talked about," says Don Busby. "Jamie Clements was a big figure in the church. There were a lot of influential people there, and it just got pushed away. I think they went to Frank Mayborn and said, 'Keep this as low profile as you can.' That's my guess. That's how the town worked. I truly believe Frank squelched all the public attention, all of it," says Mary Ann Gibson, the church deacon. "He did it because Nancy Corwin was so important to the church." "Was it a town secret?" "Yeah, I can believe that," says the prosecutor, Bob Odom. "You have to remember, there was hardly any coverage of crime in Temple at the time, certainly not in the Telegram. I'll let you speculate why that was." "I believed I knew because Frank Mayborn was a family friend. He was notoriously averse to any news that painted Temple in a bad light. This was undoubtedly a factor, but the more I delved into things, the more I began to realize another reason for such silence. Protecting the teenagers involved, especially Brenda, who remained at Temple High. She took to wearing neck scarves to hide her scars. In the high school yearbook, there is a photo of her wearing one at the senior prom. You know, this was not a normal rape," says Bob Odom. "The allegations against Brenda were so off the charts. We did try to shield her. We did want to protect her, and so, no, we didn't talk about it. Not to the press, really not to anyone." "It is a town secret. It really is," says Kathleen Person, the judge. "Those two families, they were good people, sincere people. It was a hard, quiet time, and I don't think anyone wanted to hurt them after all they'd been through. It was one of those deals where, after it happened, nobody really talked about it," says Brian Smith, the class president. "It was important that Brenda get on with her life, so the decision was made that we would just drop that. People never really knew what happened. I dated a girl in high school for 3 years, and she had never heard about it. It's something we agreed not to mention, and for the most part, we never did. For 40 years, good Lord, no one's ever talked about it. For me, it felt reassuring to know that almost everyone involved wanted what was best for Brenda and for Danny. Even so, I wonder, what if Temple hadn't forgotten about Danny? What if so many people hadn't offered their support? What if, instead of downplaying what happened, the local media had held up Danny as the worst kind of predator, someone who should never be free again? Would it have made a difference? Because the simple truth is, not one of those well-meaning, church-going people in my hometown understood the radical evil that continued to grow inside Danny Corwin. After his conviction, Danny was sent to the Ferguson unit of the Texas prison system, one of an archipelago of seven prisons scattered through and around the busy East Texas town of Huntsville, 70 miles north of Houston. A series of red brick buildings wreathed in concertina wire, Ferguson sprawls across open pastures north of town. When Danny arrived, it housed maybe 2,000 prisoners, almost all of them first-time inmates, most in their teens and 20s. Ferguson was known as a gladiator farm, a prison where new inmates sought to prove their reputations. Fistfights were commonplace. As Judge Busby had been promised, Danny was first assigned to the system's Comprehensive Treatment Center, where on June 9, 1976, he was assessed by psychologist J. A. Rimini. He exhibited a rather rigid posture, was soft-spoken and appropriate in his speech, Rimini wrote of Danny in a report. He stated that he has heard voices and seen things, classic signs of schizophrenia. What those voices may have said, or what Danny may have seen, is not explained in prison records. There is no further mention of them. Instead, diagnosed with anxiety and depression, Danny entered a course of treatment that included counseling, relaxation training, and a drug called Meloral, also known as thioridazine, an antipsychotic then used in the treatment of schizophrenia. Throughout his treatment, Danny remained placid and withdrawn. He has responded well to these techniques and at this time is functioning well in the treatment center, Rimini wrote on December 1, 1976, when Danny was taken off his medication and allowed to enter Ferguson's general population. His next step, if he chose it, would be learning a skill, something he might use to build a life once released from prison. The patient is intelligent and would probably make a satisfactory bookkeeper, Rimini wrote. The Corwins visited Danny almost every weekend. When we first started going down there, Danny was very depressed, very upset, Phil Corwin said years later. He urged his son to use his time wisely. In the only press interview he ever gave, in 1990, Phil told a Houston Chronicle reporter, "When Danny went to prison, I told him to make the best of a bad situation. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of years, but take it a day at a time. Finish high school. Take some college. Find a trade." The Ferguson unit offered a full range of high school, vocational, and junior college classes, and by all accounts, Danny followed his father's advice and became an eager and curious student. He graduated high school and took college courses at Ferguson. But it was in the vocational classes where he shone, especially in the auto mechanic shop, where he became a shop assigns or assistant teacher. In a sharp contrast to his reception at Temple High, he made a strong first impression on his new teachers and fellow inmates. "He was not the stereotype of a convict," remembers John Heyman, the counselor who oversaw Ferguson's vocational classes. "He wasn't like a convict at all. It was all, yes, sir, no, sir. He became a real fixture. I'm telling you, everyone knew Danny." Ben Pruitt, who taught cabinetry at Ferguson for 18 years, met Danny in 1979 when his renown inside the walls was growing. "You had to go through auto mechanics to get to my classroom. It was just next door, so I got to know him well," says Pruitt, today a weathered farmer. "Danny was a really good mechanic. Everybody, all the guards who brought in their cars, they were starting to ask for Danny. He was that good." I talked with Heyman and Pruitt, both now in their 70s, at a cafe on Huntsville's main square. "Danny figured out how to survive in prison," says Pruitt. "He got along with all the other inmates. I've never heard an inmate say a bad word about Danny. Most inmates, they get into arguments, squabbles. He was nicer, softer, never cursed. never said a bad word. He was always nice and polite to everyone, and that was a rare thing. Years passed. Danny turned 20 at Ferguson, then 21, 22, 23. Back in Temple, his one-time classmates were starting careers and families. Their memories of Danny began to fade. I followed him for a while afterward, several of us did, just to make sure our class was safe, kind of, says Brian Smith, the one-time class president. You know, you keep tabs on folks, that they stay far enough away, that potential damage is limited. You call the prison, you talk with the guards. But, you know, over time, you kind of stop. Life goes on. In prison, Danny lost his baby fat, growing into a lean young man with blonde hair. Sometimes he sported a mustache. By the early 1980s, he was a kind of superstar inmate at Ferguson, respected by teachers, guards, and inmates. He ran the Boy Scout troop. He taught himself to play the organ and performed at church services. During the holidays, his hand-drawn artwork, Santa's reindeer and Christmas trees, decorated the hallways and an office door or two. 35 years later, many still remember him clearly and marvel at the status he earned at Ferguson. I worked for TDC for 23 years, and I've never once known an inmate like Danny, never saw one that was given as much freedom as Danny was, says John Heyman. He was the warden's boy. He could go anywhere. He could walk through a hallway without a pass. That was unheard of. He had pretty much free movement inside the prison. I bet he never got shaken down. He was one of the most trusted inmates, Pruitt affirms. He was the top one, Heyman says, without a doubt. Danny was really the perfect inmate, Pruitt says. That's the best way to put it. The perfect inmate. He was a role model for all the other inmates. We said it many times. And in Texas during the 1970s and 1980s, model inmates didn't stay in prison long. As the state's population mushroomed, so too did the prison population. Construction on new facilities didn't keep up and overcrowding became a problem. We had no room for new inmates, John Heyman recalls, and there was tremendous pressure to get old inmates out. It was a revolving door, in the front, out the back. Traditionally, Texas inmates were eligible for parole after serving a third of their sentences. By the 1980s, to reduce overcrowding, that was cut to a quarter. And that requirement could be further reduced by good behavior, even more for completing classroom studies. Serving a quarter of his 40-year sentence, 10 years, meant Danny was technically eligible for parole in 1986. But few inmates ever earned more good time credits than he did. In all, Danny racked up an astounding 5,100 days off his sentence, or almost 14 years, mostly for finishing classes. He first applied for parole in 1981, after barely 5 years at Ferguson. His request was denied that year, and three more times in the following 3 years. Finally, in 1985, parole was granted. Danny was to be a free man after serving only 9 years. When he got paroled, that was a big deal, Heyman recalls. Word spread all around the prison. I heard some of the higher-ups were actually at the gate to bid him farewell when he walked out. We held him up as an example to everyone else, says Ben Pruitt. You can be just like Danny. You can get out early and have a bright future, too, just like Danny. Heyman is shaking his head. That kid, he says, he played us like a fiddle, like a fine violin. On November 11, 1985, Danny was paroled and returned to the new home his parents had built outside Temple. He was 27 now. Phil and Nan were so thrilled they submitted a photo for the First Presbyterian Directory of just themselves and Danny. As they had a decade earlier, many in the church rallied behind them to ensure that his transition was a smooth one. Nan now clerked at a real estate company called Barge Properties. The owner, Bill Barge, was a friend of my family's and got him a maintenance job at two of Barge's apartment complexes. At church, Danny was allowed to lead a youth group. and from his first days back home, he could claim something he had never had in his entire life. A girlfriend. It was Becky Exley, the adoring little girl he once babysat, now a 20-year-old junior at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor in Belton. Today, more than 30 years later, Becky is a successful professional living under her married name, an open, effervescent mother of two grown children with a warm smile and curly gray hair. We met at a Starbucks in a Texas town I agreed not to name. "I've never talked about this with anyone. Even my kids don't know," she told me. "There are people I've been friends with for years who know nothing about this." Like most everything else about the Corwins, Danny and Becky's story begins at First Presbyterian. Becky's father, Jack, led the choir. Nan Corwin sang in it. The two families were close, spending together Thanksgivings and the occasional vacation. Becky remembers being devastated when Danny was sent to prison. She soon found herself being driven to visit him behind Ferguson's forbidding walls. From the beginning, Nan Corwin insisted Danny have regular visitors. Family members went most often, but Becky remembers she visited Danny two or three times a year, usually accompanied by his sister, Debbie. "I look back now, and I'm amazed. I mean, what parents would send a fifth or sixth grader to prison to meet with an inmate?" she recalls. "But I did. You saw him behind two plexiglass windows with wire mesh in the middle. If you wanted to touch hands, you did it through the mesh. You talked for 2 hours. He'd always ask how we were doing. Was I scared? Not really. It was an adventure. I didn't tend to shy away from hard things." She chuckles. "I mean, come on. I dated a rapist." The adult Danny that Becky came to know seemed even less expressive than the teenage Danny, as if all his feelings were bottled up inside. Becky says he exhibited what doctors call a flat affect, a severe reduction in emotional expressiveness sometimes associated with schizophrenia and autism. "It's almost like he was robotic," she remembers. "Even when he laughed, it felt forced." Not that it mattered to Becky. By the time Danny was paroled, she had been visiting him half her life, beginning when she was 10 years old in fifth grade at Thornton Elementary, through 3 years at Bonham Junior High, 4 years at Temple High, and 2 years of college. They wrote letters as well, platonic ones. Danny made her things in the prison shops, a Bible cover and an oak wash basin. She always called him Daniel. Everything changed on a fateful day in November 1985. "The worst day of my life," Becky terms it, but laughing. The phone rings, she recalls, and it's Danny. He goes, "Hey, do you know who this is?" I go, "Oh my God. Oh my God, is this Danny?" "Yes." "Oh my God, you're home?" "Yes. I'm on my way over." Thus began an all-consuming love affair for both of them. They didn't discuss their intentions. "We just knew it had to happen," Becky says, "like it was a natural progression. I mean, there was that part of me that always had that fantasy that he would get out and we would get married. It all seemed so easy and natural to just be with Daniel. I was probably being groomed once I hit high school. I probably told his sister some fantasy I had early on, and it just blossomed from there. It was just comfortable to go from my old, bossy, overbearing boyfriend to a laid-back, easygoing guy like Danny. We both realized we would give it a try." After all, Becky knew Danny better than anyone outside his own family. She cuddled next to him when he drove the brown Ford 100 pickup truck his parents had bought him. They went to movies at Temple Mall. Their parents, especially the Corwins, pushed the relationship, telling Becky she was Danny's best chance to resume something like a normal life. "As far as his parents, it was all roses," Becky says. "I got lots of positive strokes. I should have known then that words of affirmation and acts of service were my love language. The parents gave me the words, and Danny was always working on my car, helping my mom around the house, etc." Becky recalls the Corwins were so supportive, they allowed the young couple to have sex in Danny's bedroom while the adults remained out of sight. Almost every time we had sex. Yeah, it was at the Corwins, Becky says. They were fine with it, I guess. I remember once my mom was over and she almost walked in on us. It was in the bedroom, in fact, that Becky and Danny encountered their first problems. It didn't take Becky long to realize that Danny appeared to be faking his orgasms. For some reason, he was unable to ejaculate. When Becky gently confronted him, he denied it. I kind of remember asking him about it once, and he said, "Sometimes guys just don't ejaculate when they orgasm," she says today. For the moment, Becky decided to let it go. "I never talked to anyone about it. No one," she recalls. "Yes, I knew it was weird, but who am I going to ask? I was somewhat experienced, but there was no Google in the 1980s. Who am I to doubt or call him a liar?" The fact was, Becky was too caught up in her dream of a future with Danny to care. "There are some things you just don't want to know," she says, "and I guess I just didn't want to know some things. But in my own way, I love Danny. I thought the Corwin family was everything I ever wanted." By the following spring, after dating 4 or 5 months, there was talk of marriage. Becky and Danny drove up to Waco and looked at rings. Later, Danny confided to her that he had put a deposit on one. The Corwins were elated. Outwardly, in fact, everything about Danny's new life seemed idyllic. His job was going smoothly. He was planning to enter either University of Mary Hardin Baylor or Temple Junior College in the fall. If that went well, he had always had a dream of attending Texas A&M University. Privately, though, there were signs Danny was struggling to adapt to outside life. Every week or so, under conditions of his parole, he talked with a therapist at Temple's Mental Health and Mental Retardation Facility. Investigators later compiled synopses of these discussions. Most are banal. In his first visit, Danny complained about his older sister being bossy. But others offer troubling glimpses into his psyche. In May 1986, according to these notes, Danny expressed concern that he felt like he had a closet full of trash inside himself and was afraid to open the door to see what was inside. Discussed fear of rejection by mother and guilt associated with rejection. In June, Danny complained of missing the maturation process during time in prison. In a later visit, he admitted a fear of new females and would rather avoid new females that he meets rather than to talk with them. In August, he spoke, apparently for the first time, of his attack on Brenda Evans, explaining that he had been driven by feelings of rejection, anger, etc., at not being able to fit in at Temple High. Other than in therapy, though, Danny seems to have kept this all to himself. In retrospect, it seems he wanted to become the success Becky and his parents yearned for him to be. And with every passing month, he seemed closer to fulfilling that goal. That fall, he enrolled at Mary Hardin Baylor. As the semester progressed, Danny and Becky focused their sights on Texas A&M. If he could get into A&M, it would be as if his past was washed away. Education had to happen, Becky emphasizes. That had to happen for him to ever escape the dark mark of prison. The envelope from A&M finally arrived that winter. Danny's parents were there at the house when he opened it, and a moment later when he proudly displayed an acceptance letter. When Becky arrived, there was a joyous celebration. It was as if prison had never happened. Danny was being given a new start in life. Gradually, a plan emerged. He would begin classes that coming January, 1987. The A&M campus was in College Station, 80 miles southeast. As luck would have it, a family friend, Patrick Fuller, was taking a job as a guard at the Eastham unit, and the two pals arranged to share a rented house in Madisonville, a hardscrabble town near the Huntsville prisons, and a half hour north of A&M. Becky was thrilled. She was planning to go to graduate school in Austin, but the driving distances were manageable. They would see each other on weekends. Danny's parole officer approved the plan, as did his counselor. In Madisonville, Danny would no longer be under any kind of state monitoring. The Corwins were overwhelmed. After all the years of suffering and grief, Danny's life seemed to finally be falling into place. Except it wasn't at all. A year after Danny left prison, he was spotted at a local church. John Heyman, one of his old prison instructors, stopped by the rental house. "I just drove over there, and there he was, outside," he recalls. "I just wanted to say hello. I don't think I spent 5 minutes with him." Heyman's impromptu visit, however, ended up changing the trajectory of Danny's life. Ben Pruitt, the cabinetry instructor, taught at Ferguson 5 mornings a week. At other times, he and his partner, Ed Jordan, ran an outside cabinetry business. "I remember Heyman came to me, probably later that day, and said, 'I just saw Danny Corwin. He's looking for work. Do you and Ed need help in the cabinet shop?'" Pruitt recalls. "I said, 'No, we do it all ourselves.' Then a few hours later, I asked Ed, and he said, 'Well, yeah, actually, we could use some help.' So I told Heyman, 'Tell Danny to give me a call.' And he did. I remember he told me he was going to A&M, majoring in computer science." The next morning, Danny drove up to Pruitt's shop, a pale green warehouse along a white gravel driveway next to Pruitt's farm, 5 minutes north of Huntsville. "Ed and I talked to him. You know, like all college kids, Danny was looking for extra money," Pruitt says. "He was attending A&M Tuesdays and Thursdays, but could work for us the rest of the time. We told him we'd hire him on 2 conditions, that he kept out of trouble and that he stayed in school, and he promised he would." Pruitt also offered Danny a ramshackle rental house he owned on Avenue E in downtown Huntsville, just 4 blocks west of the guard towers at The Walls, the oldest of the town's prisons. Danny's roommate, Patrick Fuller, was planning to attend Sam Houston State in Huntsville that fall, so Danny accepted. West of Madisonville, the land opens up, leaving the East Texas pines behind for the rolling pastures of family-owned ranches. Cattle graze in yellow-green fields. Horses lean over fences to munch hay bales. Normangy, with its 1 block downtown and a single stoplight, is typical of the area's towns, a hamlet of 636 people, spread around a crossroads where passing cars are outnumbered by mud-spattered pickups and tractors. February 13, 1987, dawned clear and cool at the tidy ranch house 72-year-old Alice Martin shared with her husband of 55 years, Alvin. Everyone in this corner of Madison County knew the Martins. Alvin was a county commissioner. Alice had been Normangy's postmistress for years and lived in the area all her life. After bypass surgery 10 years back, Alice had slowed a bit. She stayed around the house most days now, watching the television preachers and reading her Bible. Her grandkids, of which there were many, called her Mother Alice. That morning, as she usually did, Alice rose early and made pancakes for Alvin. After breakfast, around 7:15, she climbed into her Cadillac and drove along Highway 39 to their church, Sand Prairie Baptist Church, a low-slung yellow brick building off the corner of Farm to Market Road, 1452. Parking in the lot beside the graveyard, Alice set off walking west down the blacktop toward a line of small ranches in the distance. Every morning she paced off 1.5 miles, then returned along the same route, 3 miles in all. As she walked, she made sure to wave her arms, as her doctor had instructed, the better to increase her circulation. She usually wore a baseball cap and a pair of old slacks cut off below the knees. On breezy days, like that one, she draped a scarf around her neck. The walk rarely took more than 45 minutes. She was usually home by 8:30. Alice's grandson, David Martin, who knew her routines, drove by the church at 8:50. Saw her car in the lot and thought little of it. When he passed again at 10, though, it was still there. David sensed something was wrong. He called Alvin Martin, who agreed. Alvin called the sheriff's office. By mid-afternoon, Sheriff Ed Fannin had rounded up 50 people to cruise the winding county roads around Normangy looking for any sign of Alice. By nightfall, he had dogs and a helicopter as well. The searchers pressed on through the night. No one found a thing. Alice Martin had vanished. The search, augmented by an airplane and men on horseback, resumed at daybreak. They worked through the morning, gradually expanding the search area. Finally, around 4, the sheriff's office took a call from 3 searchers who were crisscrossing dirt roads just to the north in Robertson County. When deputies arrived, some had to turn away. Just off a county road, behind a thick copse of trees, Alice Martin's nude body lay face down beside a pond. Her clothes and the contents of her purse were strewn about. The medical examiner would later rule Alice had been raped, then strangled, and stabbed to death. But that didn't do the killer's work justice. What stayed with Minnie that day were the 2 stab wounds and the nasty slash cut into her back. There was no mistaking it. It was a smiley face. It was the first murder in the area in 10 years. Deputies from both Robertson and Madison counties began an investigation, but they had little experience for solving so brutal and unprecedented a crime. It was so unusual, in fact, a reporter for the Houston Chronicle drove in a few days later and wrote about it. "Woman's brutal murder shrouds town in fear," the headline read. "To me, it's one of the most hideous things I've ever seen," Sheriff Fannin told the reporter. "She was a fine Christian lady. Some idiot takes her life." Normangee's mayor, Gloria Connolly, was quoted saying, "Nobody used to ever lock their doors here. Now, everybody's barring the doors." Deputies interviewed mailmen, UPS drivers, and meter readers, and put up flyers seeking tips about Alice's murder around Madisonville and Bryan College Station. A teenager swore he had seen a brown pickup on the road the morning she was taken, but even after they hypnotized him, it led nowhere. Someone called in a tip about a church cult given to sacrificing pigs. But the only suspect deputies identified was one of Alice's close relatives who, it was said, had extensive gambling debts to mafia-linked loan sharks. None of it led anywhere, and by the end of spring, the investigation was pretty much over. Every weekend, Danny drove home to Temple to spend time with his family and with Becky. While he had made undeniable progress getting into A&M and finding a good job, everyone remained acutely aware that he needed to remain on the right track. "I knew he was already 2 steps behind people his age because he had been in prison," Becky remembers. "So he can't be just a good person to catch up. He has to be a great person. The fact is, I was probably pressuring him as much as his parents were." This manifested itself in Becky monitoring details of Danny's life that another girlfriend might have ignored. For instance, Becky remembers finding a past due notice of some kind from Montgomery Ward on Danny's dresser. When she pressed him, he insisted he had already paid the bill. When Becky demanded to see the canceled check, Danny went to his truck and returned with one. But later, when Becky studied its number, she realized it was a new check, meaning Danny had just written it in the truck. "So that wasn't just evidence he hadn't paid the bill," she recalls. "To me, it was evidence that my future husband couldn't handle his finances. So yeah, it worried me." Becky had called him in small lies before. A turning point came that spring when Danny was living in Madisonville. One morning, Becky discovered Danny had left his wallet behind in Temple. She phoned the auto repair shop where Danny said he was then working and was stunned when the person who answered the phone said he had never heard of Danny Corwin. Becky went to Danny's father. Phil shared her concern. She remembers he volunteered that Danny had a problem admitting failure to them. She doesn't remember much more about the conversation or whether she later confronted Danny. But Becky remembers clearly the incident changed everything. Deep down, she realized she couldn't trust him. Not with her future. Their relationship began to deteriorate. Danny started to miss weekend trips to Temple. Becky took herself out of town a few times when he did return. For the first time, she allowed herself to think about a future without Danny or the Corwins. She had been a part of their family for so long, it was almost incomprehensible. "It wasn't just breaking up with Danny," she recalls. "It was breaking up with the whole Corwin family." The capper came in April, after she and Danny drove to Oklahoma to visit Becky's sister. Her period was late. This was probably the nail in the coffin, she says. My thought was a kind of panic, as it was later in the relationship, and I wondered what it would be like to be forever yoked to this family. By summer, they had stopped having sex. They had planned to take a trip to California with her mother, but at the last minute, Becky asked Danny not to come. As was typical, he showed no obvious reaction. When Danny and Patrick Fuller had moved into the aging rental home in Huntsville that June, anyone would have marveled at the progress Danny had made since leaving Ferguson. He was engaged to be engaged with a loving hometown girl. He was studying computers at A&M, and he was becoming a valued employee at Personal Touch Cabinets. Only it all wasn't true. Only Danny knew how shaky his foundations had become. Becky had grown distant, and he was flunking out of A&M. In May, the college made it official. He was not invited back. It doesn't appear Danny told a soul, not even, perhaps especially, his parents. It must have been devastating, as his next decision suggests. Danny decided to keep up appearances and pretend he was still attending college. That summer and into the fall, he still hoisted a backpack full of books and papers and disappeared every Tuesday and Thursday, telling everyone he was off to classes. Oh, yeah, every day. We'd ask Danny how classes were going, and every day he told us some story of how great he was doing, Ben Pruitt recalls. What did he do those two lost days a week? No one will ever know. Only at work was Danny thriving. At first, Pruitt told him to come in when they did, after lunch. But Danny proved so good at everything they asked of him, assembling and sanding cabinets, fixing their trucks and tractors, that, much as at Ferguson, he was soon given his own key and full run of the warehouse. When they installed finished cabinetry for a client, Danny proved a reliable helper, doing whatever they asked of him. Pruitt's big job that spring was at a new office center on the southern edge of Huntsville, right beside Interstate 45. The Huntsville Vision Center was a one-stop optometry shop. Pruitt and his partner Ed Jordan built, painted, and installed all its display cases. The optician, who worked in the shop alone, was a 27-year-old with long brown hair named Deborah Ewing, who often walked around barefoot as she worked. Danny helped install cabinetry at the Vision Center all through June. Then, on Tuesday, July 7th, Ben Pruitt's father died. The funeral was Thursday in the East Texas town of Nacogdoches. Ed Jordan drove over with Danny to attend. They returned to Huntsville that same night and were already out finishing a job when Pruitt returned the next day, Friday, around noon. Their final stop that afternoon was back at the Vision Center, where Deborah Ewing greeted them warmly. Jordan had brought along a camera to take photographs of their finished work. "They came back to our shop about 4. Pruitt recalls. "When they showed up, I remember Danny was going back to Temple for the weekend. Ed needed to pay him something, I think for working on his tractor, and he did. I think he gave him a check. I remember Danny standing there at the back door of the shop, and I said, 'Go have a good weekend. Stay out of trouble, okay?' Danny promised he would." Not long after Danny left the shop that day, a young woman named Gina Schoenfeld was working in the Prudential Financial offices, which adjoined the Huntsville Vision Center. She was in a bathroom cleaning coffee mugs when, just after 4:30, Deborah Ewing burst through the door that connected the two offices. "Help!" Ewing blurted. Schoenfeld stepped out of the bathroom. She could tell Ewing was in serious distress. "What's wrong?" she asked. Suddenly, Ewing dropped her purse and glanced down. "I just peed all over myself," she said. "What's wrong?" Schoenfeld repeated. "There's a man out there with a gun," Ewing said, motioning toward the parking lot. "Well, let's go lock the front door," Schoenfeld said. She had just taken a step toward the door when, glancing out the front windows and just below a set of hanging blinds, she glimpsed the lower body of a man holding something in his hand that might have been a gun. Schoenfeld turned around and ran into a rear office, locking the door behind her. In her panic, she ran right past a startled Deborah Ewing. In the office, Schoenfeld scrunched beneath the desk and called 911. At that moment, a Huntsville police officer named David Watson happened to be turning into a convenience store directly across the interstate. 1 minute later, when a dispatcher called for someone to respond, he veered out of its parking lot and crossed the highway. When Watson drove up to the Prudential office 70 seconds later, he saw no one. With reports of what's today called an active shooter, he was obliged to wait for backup. When a second officer arrived, Watson grabbed a shotgun and the two men went into the Prudential office. As they did, Gina Schoenfeld emerged from her hiding place into a hallway and, not expecting to see them, was so startled she screamed. After she explained the situation, they called for Ewing. There was no answer. She wasn't in her store. All they found of her, in fact, was her purse and her green shoes lying on the sidewalk behind the vision center. She had vanished. More officers and detectives were quickly summoned to the scene. "We called the whole department in," remembers Gary Howes, then the police lieutenant overseeing criminal investigations. "We didn't find that much. No sign of a struggle. When you came in, nothing seemed out of place. We searched the Vision Center office, did our fingerprinting and everything. But that was about it. We were there maybe an hour. We had a missing person at that point, so we got info on her, asked people to call in, you know, but our hands were pretty much tied at that point." They got one lead that first night. Gina Schoenfeld was able to describe the lower body of the man she had seen through the blinds. He wore a dark brown pullover over a short-sleeve shirt and corduroy pants. 2 hours later, when Officer Watson spoke to the Vision Center's owner, Ruth Roth, he made what should have been a breakthrough. Roth said a young man wearing a similar outfit had been at the store that day. Danny Corwin. Ben Pruitt remembers a Huntsville detective named Larry McDougal calling him with questions. Handwritten notes contained in police files suggest the call was in fact made the next day. "Whatever the case, I was still at the shop," Pruitt recalls. He called and said, "Hey, Ben, did you have a guy over at the Vision Center taking pictures today?" "Yes," Pruitt said. "It was Ed Jordan, but neither considered him a suspect." But Pruitt went on, "I do have an ex-convict working for me. You should make sure he isn't involved." Pruitt identified Danny and mentioned he had served a term for some kind of rape in Temple during the 1970s. Later that Saturday, the day after Ewing's disappearance, Officer Watson called and spoke to an officer in Temple, who dug out Danny's arrest record. Detectives were still working the case the next morning, a Sunday, when a realtor began showing a man from Sugarland a vacant lot in a planned subdivision called Paradise Cove, overlooking Lake Conroe, 25 miles south of Huntsville and neighboring Montgomery County. The men were kicking through the brush when they stumbled upon a woman's body, naked from the waist down. When police were called, they identified the body as that of Deborah Ewing. She had been stabbed twice in the chest. Later that day, as police fanned across the area in search of clues, they were approached by a group of teenagers. They said they had been playing near the lake late Friday afternoon and thought they had heard something strange in the distance. They were almost certain it was the sound of a woman screaming. The Huntsville Police Department and its 28 officers were housed in a yellow brick building a block off the town square. None of its four detectives had much experience investigating murders. "The county had maybe one a year," recalls one law officer from the era. "They were good on property crimes. They were horrible on anything more complicated," sighs an investigator for another agency. "What we would refer to as a killing, somebody getting mad at somebody and shot him, well, that they could solve. I cannot remember an unsolved killing case where they cleared it. If there was not a known suspect, they just didn't get anywhere. Never did." The investigation into Deborah Ewing's murder, carried out in tandem with the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, would not be the Huntsville Department's finest moment. That Monday morning, when detectives met with a veteran Texas Ranger named Bill Quinn, everybody agreed Danny was a viable suspect. One of them called Ben Pruitt at his shop and asked him to bring him in for questioning. When Danny drove up a little later, Pruitt explained the situation, and Danny went quietly, climbing into Pruitt's truck. At the station, the two were led into an office. Bill Quinn was sitting behind a desk. Danny took a seat to his left, Pruitt beside him. Three Huntsville officers, including the lead detective, Wayne Woods, took the remaining seats. "That ranger sat and looked at Danny the whole time," Pruitt recalls. "The ranger did all the talking. I sat there and listened. I watched the whole time. Danny was talking. I've seen people lie. Inmates lie. There was no sign that Danny was lying. The ranger would circle back and ask the same question again, going over things, and Danny never tripped up, never faltered." Danny said he had nothing to do with Ewing's death. He said that after leaving Pruitt's shop Friday afternoon, he was driving toward Temple when he thought of bringing his parents a watermelon. He said he remembered seeing a watermelon stand, but after driving around a bit was unable to find it. After that, he said, he drove on to Temple. Quinn walked him through the story several times. Danny repeated it the same way each time. Later, after Danny and Pruitt left, the lawmen debated whether there had been enough time for Danny to return to the Vision Center to kidnap Ewing. According to handwritten notes one of them took of a conversation with Pruitt, Pruitt said Danny had left his shop around 4:20. The shop and the Vision Center were on opposite ends of Huntsville. Officers timed the route between them at 14 minutes. Ewing had seen the man outside her office between 4:30 and 4:35. By that estimate, Danny had maybe 10 to 15 minutes to return. Detective Woods believed Danny couldn't have made the drive in time. That, along with Danny's unruffled demeanor, led the detectives to eliminate him as an active suspect. It was a decision that would haunt them all. "We eliminated him, but we hadn't, you know," Gary Howells remembers. He points to the back of his head. "He was always in there, you know. We couldn't put him at the scene, but a lot of the characteristics were there from the Temple case. It was very similar. But his alibis and everything, it was steady. And getting back there in time, it would be a stretch. And there was the impression he left in that interview. He was, well, laid back. You didn't see the anxiety, the nervousness we'd expect." Looking back from a distance of 30 years, several area lawmen told me the lead detective, Wayne Woods, who has since died, was badly out of his depth. Woods was an older officer who had come up through the ranks. "Wayne shouldn't have been in that job. He needed more training," says an investigator from another agency who later worked the Ewing case. "I liked Wayne. Nice fellow. But the fact was, he was fairly incompetent. And Bill Quinn was not the ranger regularly assigned to Walker County. He was in on some kind of temporary assignment, and he had been in his job too long." Having eliminated Danny as a suspect, Woods and his team focused their energies instead on Deborah Ewing's husband, a one-time tavern owner, and on her former employer, Huntsville Ophthalmologists. Nothing came of either effort, however, and by September, 6 weeks after the murder, the investigation into Ewing's murder had slowed to a halt. As evening neared on Saturday, October 31st, 1987, the streets of Huntsville began filling with trick-or-treaters, the youngest with their smiling parents. Late that afternoon, 36-year-old Mary Correll Rissinger returned to her tidy mobile home behind her parents' house after a long day in Houston with her daughter, Kristen, who was almost four. Kristen, who was wearing a white ballerina costume, had been in a beauty pageant in Houston that day, and as they sat down for an early dinner, she wanted to attend another event that night at the Halloween carnival at the Walker County Fairgrounds. "If you eat all your supper, we'll take you to the carnival," Mary told her. At the last moment, Mary's younger sister, Sarah Berger, who had gone with them that day, begged off. She was to be named Kristen's godmother in a church ceremony the next morning, and she wanted to get her clothes in order. The Correls were prominent members of Huntsville's law enforcement community. Mary's father was a guard at the walls. Her brother was a policeman. Sarah's brother-in-law was a sheriff's deputy, fresh off a tough marital split, Mary, a warm, petite woman who wore her brown hair short and spiky, had worked clerical duties at Southwestern Bell for 17 years. A little after 5, Mary drove Kristen in their white Cadillac to the fairgrounds. They were seen leaving at 7:40. On the way home, Mary decided to wash her car. She pulled into the Max Car Wash, a brown brick open-air do-it-yourself facility on Farm to Market Road 2821, the road that runs across Huntsville's northern reaches. She pulled into the fourth bay, put some coins into a machine, and activated a water hose. It was dusk. As Mary washed her car, a 33-year-old Walker County detective named Dusty Dauger, having finished his own family's trick-or-treating for the evening, pulled his Ford 150 up to the sheriff's office, barely a quarter mile up the road from the car wash. Leaving his wife and two young sons in the truck, Dauger went inside, curious to see whether there was any mischief around town that might require his attention. He was standing in the lobby, chatting with the dispatcher, when three out-of-breath women burst in. "There's a dead person," one yelled. "At the car wash," another shouted. "She's dead." Telling the dispatcher to broadcast the news immediately, Dauger ran to his truck, hopped in, and sped to the car wash in less than a minute. Just as he pulled into the driveway, he saw what he thought was a body lying beside a white Cadillac. "Just stay here," he told his wife. "I'm going to check it out." Dauger stopped the truck, stepped out, and locked the doors. He had just taken his first steps toward the Cadillac, the fallen body in sight, when he heard a car door slam. He glanced back to his truck, thinking his wife had gotten out. That's when he saw something move inside the Cadillac, in the back seat. He realized it was a small girl dressed as a ballerina, and she was frantically closing and locking its doors. Weirdly, she seemed to be red. To his amazement, Dauger realized the girl was covered in blood. Her eyes were wild. She jumped into the front seat. "I'm a friend. I'm a policeman," Dauger said, trying to establish eye contact. "Please come out, and I can help you." The girl locked the remaining car doors. Dauger repeated himself twice more to no effect. Finally, he took out his badge and thrust it toward the car. "Can you open the door?" he asked. "I'm a police officer. Please, let me help you." Suddenly, one of the car doors burst open. The girl darted out and wrapped her arms tightly around Dauger's legs. Her first words were, "My mother has been killed. Please help me." Dauger lifted her into his arms. "Don't let the bad man get me," the girl kept saying. "Don't let the bad man get me." She was shaking violently. At the same time, Dauger realized she was unhurt. The blood that covered her from head to toe was apparently not her own. He carried her to his truck and motioned for his wife. "Give me that blanket," he said, motioning to one inside. "I need to get this girl covered up." Cruisers and unmarked police cars began arriving within minutes. Officers quickly deduced the body was that of Mary Rissinger. She was lying in bay number 3 with a water hose running beneath her left arm. From the bruises on her face and the cuts up and down her arms, it appeared she had put up a desperate struggle. Death had come from 2 deep stab wounds in her neck, which severed her jugular vein. Blood was everywhere. As officers cordoned off the scene, Dauger sat to one side with Kristen, acutely aware he had missed the killer by mere minutes. Whoever it was, he was still driving through the streets of Huntsville, making his getaway. Dauger gently questioned Kristen, hoping she could help them find him. "I asked her, 'Where did the bad man go?' he remembers. She pointed back to the east, and I said, 'What was he driving?' She said, 'A truck.' 'What color?' And she said, 'Like yours.'" Dauger's Ford was two-tone brown. Within minutes, an alert was broadcast for a brown pickup. Dauger, today a veteran detective with a state agency, wipes a tear from his eyes as we talk in a Huntsville cafe. "Sorry, it still breaks me up," he says. In my 37 years doing this, I've never had something like that happen, before or since. If you find Kristen, you tell her hi for me, would you? He sniffs. I still think of her, you know? At the sheriff's office that night, a psychologist was brought in to interview Kristen in hopes she could offer a description of the bad man. Their talks stretched into the wee hours and continued for several days, but Kristen had little to add. Ben Pruitt was stunned to hear of Mary Rissinger's murder. He knew almost all the Carell family. He had once dated Mary's sister. He studied an artist's drawing of a brown pickup in the newspaper. He thought of Danny, whose truck was brown. But the truck in the drawing had bars on its rear window. Danny's didn't. That Monday morning, when Danny arrived at the shop for work, Pruitt noticed a large white bandage on his left hand. "What in the world happened to your hand?" he asked. Danny said he had been opening a can of cocoa to make hot chocolate and had cut himself. Pruitt thought little of it. The investigation into Mary Rissinger's gruesome murder fell to the Walker County Sheriff's Office, whose four detectives had scant more experience working major homicides than the Huntsville police. Their problem, at least in those first few hectic days, wasn't a lack of leads to pursue. It was coping with the sheer amount of leads flooding in from townspeople. "I mean, we were swamped with people calling," recalls the easygoing lead detective, Byron Bush, who remains with the sheriff's office 30 years later. "People called about every brown pickup in Walker County. It was a challenge to just categorize all this. I don't think we even had a computer back then. You know what we had? Carbon paper. We had carbon paper." These were the days before pervasive closed-circuit cameras, before widespread DNA testing, and before serial killers had become a popularly understood phenomenon. "We had blood samples, blood spatter, and we had the little girl," Bush says. "I probably knew the term DNA, but that was about it." Bush chuckles ironically. "And serial killer? I mean, you might as well tell me the guy was building an A-bomb on the north side of town. Maybe I'd heard the term, but that was not something you looked at. Not in Huntsville, Texas in 1987. In those first days, detectives focused instead on finding a witness, someone driving by who had seen something. One man came forward, claiming he had seen a brown pickup at the car wash, but nothing else. "We checked neighbors, businesses. No one saw anything," Bush says. "From the calls, we had stacks of leads, and we went through it all. We tried to, anyway." The Carell family had its own ideas who was responsible. They were convinced Rissinger's estranged husband had done it. "Her family just wore me out. Wore me out," Bush says. A prolonged investigation, however, established that the man had been on a hunting trip in Colorado at the time. Once he was cleared, Bush had no other promising suspects. The investigation waned. "There were only so many things you could do," says Bush. "People were still getting hurt and robbed. We had other work, too." The Rissinger investigation, like that into Deborah Ewing's death, petered out. The Houston Chronicle ran a brief article wondering if the Ewing and Rissinger killings had links, but the police found none. Not until much later would Byron Bush suffer a forehead-slapping moment when he revisited that stack of leads and found someone had phoned in a tip about a Huntsville man with a brown pickup truck and unusual cuts on his left hand. It was Danny. Someone had, in fact, been suspicious. But there is no indication anyone ever followed up on the lead. And then for the longest time, nothing happened. Nothing much at all. Becky finally and officially broke up with Danny over the holidays. All that winter and into the spring of 1988, Danny kept to his routines, working with Ben Pruitt, driving to A&M to attend classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, living quietly with Patrick Fuller on Avenue E in Huntsville, heading home most weekends to see his family. At work, he helped Pruitt install his first computer software system. Pruitt was amazed. He began telling everyone that Danny was a computer whiz. Was Danny struggling with his urges? with what he had done? There are hints he was. When in Temple, he still attended church with his parents. The old minister, Wilson Keenan, had been eased out after the Brenda Evans episode. The new minister, Ralph Person, later told his daughter Kathleen, the city judge, about an incident that probably occurred in 1988. One night, the sexton called my dad and said there's a light on in the church, in the balcony, she recalls. Dad went over. There was Danny in the balcony. He had broken in. He was sad. He seemed distraught. He wouldn't tell Dad what was wrong, but it was something. I guess Dad talked him into going back home. By summer, Danny had made some new friends. He and Ben Pruitt's son hunted and fished together. He began dating his roommate's sister and in September took her to A&M to show her around. For a solid year, in fact, the only thing of note that happened to Danny was he got a speeding ticket. In a bizarre coincidence, the officer who gave it to him was Larry Martin, Alice Martin's grandson. When Danny didn't pay the ticket, an arrest warrant was sworn out, and on September 29th, Martin found Danny at his house and arrested him. At the Walker County Jail, he was fingerprinted. Presumably ashamed to call his parents or Ben Pruitt, Danny phoned his old auto mechanics instructor, Mark Lenorman, who also worked as a reserve officer for the Walker County Sheriff. Lenorman came to the jail and got Danny released. For some reason, Lenorman also decided to take his photo, snapping a pair of Polaroids, which he then inserted into Danny's file. 3 weeks later, everything began to unravel. That day, Thursday, October 20th, 1988, having finished her last class around noon, Wendy Gaunt strode through the parking lots that sprawled around Kyle Field, Texas A&M's cavernous football stadium. A petite sophomore from Austin who wore her brown hair in a bob, Wendy was driving her mother's blue and white Suburban that week. She rode horses, and her own car was too small to pull a trailer. When she reached the Suburban, she opened the door and tossed her things into the passenger side floorboard. Sliding behind the wheel, she remembered her sunglasses and reached down to lift them out of her purse. When she sat upright once more, Danny was standing at the open car door. He was holding a knife. Later, Wendy wouldn't remember what, if anything, he said. Instinctively, she scrambled across the seats to escape out the passenger door, but Danny was too fast. He leaped into the car and, before she knew it, pinned her arms behind her and looped a nylon cord around her wrists, cinching it tight. Then, as if he had practiced the move beforehand, he tied the cord to a seatbelt. Danny grabbed his backpack and tossed it in the back seat. "Are you a student?" was all Wendy could think to say. She was looking at the backpack. "No," he said, "but it looks good." After starting the engine, Danny wheeled out of the parking lot and headed down Welborn Road. Wendy struggled to remain calm. "Where are we going?" she asked. "What are we doing?" "I just need your car," Danny said. "I'm just going to take it and put you out somewhere." As they headed east onto Highway 6, Wendy kept asking, "What are you going to do to me? Are you going to hurt me?" "No, I'm not going to hurt you," Danny said, staring straight ahead. "I just need the car." They drove east for a full 15 minutes as Danny grew impatient with Wendy's persistent questioning. "Just shut up," he said at one point, "or I'm going to cut your throat." Finally, on the southeast edge of College Station, Danny turned off the road and drove down into Lick Creek Park, coming to a stop in a gravel parking lot. It was deserted. There was no one in sight. The heavily wooded park was under construction. Roads from the lot were still being built. A series of walking trails snaked off into the trees. Danny got out, opened Wendy's door, and pulled her from the Suburban. "Wait, I need my books," she said, assuming he would take the car. "I need my purse." "Come on," he said, pushing her in front of him, her hands still tied. "We're going to walk down this trail." Wendy did as he said, walking into the greenery. "I thought you were going to leave," she said at one point. "I am," Danny replied. We're just going to go down this trail a little ways, so you can't see what direction I leave. They had walked maybe 50 yards when Danny shoved her between a gap in the bushes into a tiny clearing. There he pushed her down onto the ground and began fumbling with the clasp of her skirt. He couldn't find it. Where is it? He asked. In the back. Danny took off her clothes and began to rape her. At one point, Wendy glanced up toward the road as a line of heavy trucks rumbled by. She could see their tops. Danny became distracted. He made her get up and pushed her deeper into the woods, where he continued raping her. When he was done, he tied her to a tree facing forward, her arms tied loosely around the trunk. Wendy struggled to hold her composure as Danny stood behind her, silent. I know you're going to hurt me. I know you're going to, she said. You said you weren't going to hurt me. I'm not, Danny said. I'm not. Wendy realized the knots around her arms were loose and began to try and untie them. Suddenly, without warning, the knife appeared beside her throat and Danny slashed it all the way across. Wendy dropped to her knees and, having loosened the knots sufficiently, was able to bring her hands to her throat. I knew what he did, she testified years later. When I pulled my hands away, there was blood everywhere. I didn't know what to do, and I could see him out of the corner of my eye still there. And I knew that he wasn't going to leave until he thought I was dead. So I laid on the ground with my hands at my waist, and I just held my breath and was real still. After a bit, her eyes still pressed shut, she heard the crackling of leaves and twigs and realized he was leaving. And I laid there for a second, and I was just thinking to myself what it was going to be like to die, Wendy recalled. I was just thinking and thinking. I was bleeding all over. My hands were just filling with pools of blood every time I pulled them away. Just blood. And I was scared. And I just laid there and I said, okay, I'm not going to die. I'm going to get out of here. Or I'm going to get somewhere that if I do, they'll find me. Somehow, in a moment eerily reminiscent of what Brenda Evans had endured 13 years earlier, Wendy Gaunt rose to her feet and staggered out onto the path. She was weakening fast. It was taking everything I had. I was trying to hold my neck so it would stop the bleeding, and I was concentrating so hard just to move one foot at a time, just to walk. And I came around the clearing of trees. I could see the little parking area. And Danny. He was still there, sitting in the Suburban. Wendy stood deathly still, blood oozing from her slashed throat, and watched Danny. Many rapists, one presumes, would have raced from the scene of his crime. But Danny lingered. Was he going over what had happened? Was he trying to imprint those memories? So I thought, if he sees me, he's going to come back and really kill me, Wendy would testify. So I backed up and, like, hid behind a bigger bush, and I just sat there, holding my neck, just praying, please leave so I can get out of here. And after a bit, he did, driving the Suburban up out of the park and disappearing down the road toward College Station. The moment he did, Wendy lurched from her hiding place into the parking lot. She had walked maybe 150 yards and was faltering fast. She stumbled up the slope to the road, and that's when she gave out. She could go no further. She collapsed at the park entrance, praying someone could see her from the road. A county employee, W.T. Gilbert, driving by in his truck, spotted her there a few minutes later. He ran up, then quickly returned to his truck. Wendy could hear him talking over a radio. A moment later, he returned. I'm going to get you some help, he said. Just wait right here. I'll be right back. An ambulance appeared, then police. Wendy was whisked to Humana Hospital, where doctors hustled her into surgery. Within an hour, Lick Creek Park was crawling with uniformed officers. Later that afternoon, Patrick Fuller and his girlfriend appeared at Ben Pruitt's workshop looking for Danny. He's late today, Pruitt said. Well, he wasn't at the house, Fuller said. A half hour after they left, Danny drove up. Pruitt remembers the moment clearly. He wasn't dressed like he normally would for work, he says. You could tell he'd taken a bath. There was just something about the way he was dressed, like he was going to go somewhere. He looked like he was going to town, going to a party. I thought that was kind of odd. Karen Taylor, at 36, was the department's first and only forensic artist. She was nervous as she and her supervisor stepped into their boss's office in downtown Austin. She had never met Joe Murphy, the vaunted head of the Texas Department of Public Safety's Criminal Intelligence Division. Usually, at her desk in the basement, she immersed herself in the nitty-gritty of crime-solving, sculpting faces that brought the skulls of unidentified murder victims to life and, sometimes, interviewing crime victims to draw sketches of their attackers. And that, Joe Murphy announced as Taylor and her supervisor took seats across his desk, was what the College Station police had called asking her to do. Draw a sketch. There was just one catch. The victim couldn't talk. Her throat had been cut. Could they help? Well, that's just ridiculous, snapped the supervisor, who thought Taylor's work was of little use. She has no business whatsoever going down there. Murphy nodded, then turned to Taylor. Well, Karen, what do you think? He asked. Well, she said, choosing her words carefully so as not to further annoy her supervisor, who openly loathed her, I'd like to try. Which is how, over her supervisor's opposition, Karen Taylor found herself at the door of Wendy Gaunt's hospital room the following Monday morning. Wendy was battered but alert, a tracheal tube inserted into her neck, which was covered with thick white bandages. As Taylor introduced herself and pulled up a chair, the only sound came from the loud, rhythmic pounding of the respirator machine that was allowing Wendy to breathe. 30 years later, I watch as Taylor, now a sought-after lecturer on forensic artistry, leafs through an old file in her immaculate home office north of Austin. These, she says, lifting out three sheets of yellowing paper, are the original handwritten notes from the hospital that day, everything Wendy told me. See, I even had her initial them. Here in a college sophomore's looping script are the words that, along with hours of nods and thumbs-ups, allowed Taylor to do her job. From the police, Taylor already had a general sense what Wendy's assailant looked like, but in an effort to put her at ease, she went through it all again. Yes, Wendy nodded. He was white. Age? Late 20, maybe early 30, she wrote. Was he more of a good-looking guy, average-looking guy? Not ugly, but more on ugly side, she wrote. What was he wearing? Taylor asked. Jeans, plaid shirt. Was the shirt starched or wrinkled? Not starch, not wrinkle. Royal blue, mostly. Was he skinny or fat? Taylor asked. Flabby, but not fat. And his hair? More dirty blonde, kind of streaks of lighter, darker. Wendy Gaunt, Taylor quickly realized, was an unusually strong woman. Some crime victims cry or waver or have trouble calling up memories. Wendy was focused, intent, and angry. Yet, amazingly, she retained her sense of humor. When Taylor remarked that her assailant's plaid shirt was a little ugly, Wendy scribbled, "You're not his kind of person." At one point, Taylor took out an FBI manual of facial features. They leafed through it, Wendy pointing at similar eyes, similar ears, similar eyeglasses. When Taylor traced out two pairs of eyes, Wendy chose the better match. When Taylor asked about the shirt, she drew a stick figure with a plaid shirt. They worked like this for 2 hours until Taylor thought Wendy needed a break. You tired? She asked. Don't have anywhere to go, Wendy scribbled, smiling. They worked into the afternoon, the two of them eventually growing so comfortable, Taylor sat on the bed beside her. Finally, after erasing and resketching the face a dozen or more times, Taylor handed it to her. "You think this is as close as we can get it?" she asked. Wendy Gaunt smiled and gave a thumbs up. Afterward, Karen Taylor handed the finished sketch to a College Station detective. It went on local news broadcasts that evening, a Monday. Within an hour, the call came in. Ben Pruitt worked late that evening and didn't see the news. He was in the shop early the next morning when the phone rang. It was Sheriff Ed Fannin from Madison County. "Do you have a Daniel Corwin who works for you?" he asked. "Yes, sir, I do. What's the problem?" "Well, did you see that deal over in College Station?" "No, sir." "What are you talking about?" Fannin described the assault. "Danny Corwin is suspected of being the person behind the attack," the sheriff said. Pruitt was skeptical. He knew how police could be drawn to ex-cons in these situations. He related Danny's story, said he was clean-cut and stayed out of trouble, and urged Fannin to be certain of the allegations before arresting him. Fannin mentioned the sketch. Someone, apparently a guard at the Ferguson unit, had called a Crime Stoppers line and identified it as Danny. Later, Pruitt took a call from Frank Hidalgo, an up-and-coming sheriff's investigator who would take a leading role in the investigation. Hidalgo asked him to come to the sheriff's office. Pruitt hopped into his truck and was at the station in minutes. Inside, Hidalgo handed him a copy of the sketch. There was no doubt. Pruitt collapsed in a chair. "I've seen a lot of sketches," Pruitt recalls. "I've never seen one that was so perfect. Down to the pins in his pocket, the glasses, it was perfect. It was Danny." Pruitt told Hidalgo about the cuts on Danny's hand after Mary Rissinger's murder. Hidalgo promised to stay in touch. A sketch, even one as dead-on as this, was not enough for an arrest. Corroborating evidence was needed. Hidalgo drove to College Station that Tuesday, received a briefing on the Wendy Gaunt attack, then returned to Huntsville to send on a set of Danny's photos and fingerprints taken after his earlier arrest. When Ben Pruitt arrived at his shop that day, Danny was already there. Pruitt had confided in his partner, Ed Jordan. Both men were understandably nervous. Did Danny know about the sketch? Was he dangerous? They didn't know, and for the moment, they were entirely on their own. "It was all we could do to keep this to ourselves," Pruitt says. "Let me tell you, it was hard. It plays on your mind. The whole day you got to work with him, standing side by side, all the while knowing what he had done. Can you imagine? Those were the hardest days of my life." Danny gave no sense he knew something was afoot as Hidalgo began phoning the shop. He told Pruitt they were planning to arrest Danny there, likely the next day, Wednesday. He asked for a description of Danny's truck, then of the warehouse. Each time he called, Pruitt stepped into his office while Jordan, to ensure Danny didn't overhear, ran a sander at ear-splitting levels. At one point, Pruitt remembered his guns. He had a dozen pistols and shotguns in an office cabinet. Danny knew it. Pruitt emptied all the ammunition and took it to the house. Then, complications arose. Inexplicably, Wendy couldn't conclusively identify Danny from the photos. Police hadn't found any of his fingerprints in her Suburban. Without a firm identification or any physical evidence, an arrest was out of the question. For several hours that Wednesday, the situation hung in limbo. Then, out of the blue, a technician named Barry Wilkerson double-checked the Suburban and discovered a single, unidentified fingerprint. There was a chance it was Danny's. They tried to match it to the prints taken in Huntsville, but Danny had been wearing a bandage on two of his fingers at the time. He had apparently cut himself at work, rendering the prints unusable. Exasperated, the College Station police called Temple and asked for their set. This was 1988. Temple promised to mail them. The Huntsville authorities, however, now suspecting Danny might be responsible for the murders of Mary Rissinger and Deborah Ewing, were taking no chances. Thursday morning, they put him under surveillance. Outside Ben Pruitt's shop, one officer took up position in a shack across the road, another in a nearby subdivision. That evening, after following him home to the house on Avenue E, Frank Hidalgo and others hunched in a surveillance van down the street. By dawn on Friday, October 28th, everyone was in place to do it all over again. Then, that afternoon, the fingerprints from Temple arrived in College Station. Compared to the print found in the Suburban, there was no doubt. They were the same. At that point, as the sun began to set, a local prosecutor drew up arrest and search warrants. At 8:30, a judge signed them. A convoy of College Station officers and prosecutors headed to Huntsville. They pulled up outside the sheriff's office there around 9:30. Frank Hidalgo was summoned from the surveillance van to join them. "When I get to the sheriff's office, there's like an army there," Hidalgo says. "The whole place is full of people." Danny was alone at his house, Hidalgo reported. No one wanted to risk an armed confrontation or SWAT-type situation. Danny needed to be drawn outside, where he could be taken unarmed. Someone suggested they ease an unmarked car into the driveway and bump into his parked truck. Once Danny came out to inspect the damage, they could take him. Everyone agreed it sounded workable. Hidalgo and the detective who led the Mary Rissinger investigation, Byron Bush, volunteered to stage the accident. "We had an old Ford Thunderbird, something we had seized, sitting out back, so we used that," Hidalgo remembers. "So we get in this old T-Bird and take a can of beer and splash it all over ourselves. We were going to act like we were drunk." Lawmen soon began taking up positions in the surrounding streets, many of them in sight of the well-lit guard posts atop the walls, four blocks east. A little after 10, Detective Bush, with Hidalgo at his side, eased the Thunderbird into the narrow confines of E Street, which was no wider than an alley. Glancing toward the house, they could see the truck in the driveway. The street was quiet. Bush slowly pulled past the house, then gently reversed and turned toward the driveway, backing toward the truck's rear bumper. Suddenly, Hidalgo whispered, "Wait." There was movement in the living room. Hidalgo could see Danny's outstretched legs in the glow of a television screen. "He's right inside, watching TV," Hidalgo said. "Okay," Bush breathed. Bush felt a solid thud when he struck the truck's bumper. Both men got out of the car and made as if to inspect any damage. When Danny didn't stir, they stepped up onto the porch. The screen door was open. "Hey, man, we're sorry," Bush said to Danny. "We're not seeing anything, no real damage." "It's okay," Danny said from inside. He remained seated, making no effort to come inspect the truck. "No, man, come on and check it out," Bush said. "We don't want you calling the cops on us after we've left." Danny rose from his chair, pushed through the screen door, and stepped into the yard. When he was within reach, both Bush and Hidalgo grabbed one of his arms. "Sheriff's office, motherfucker," one said. "You're under arrest." Danny stood still, saying nothing, and allowed them to press him face down beside the driveway. They brought his hands behind his back and handcuffed him. Within seconds, officers began streaming into the little yard. It was over. Danny was taken to College Station and put in jail. News of his arrest, complete with speculation linking him to the murders of Deborah Ewing and Mary Rissinger, ran in newspapers across Texas. In Temple, those who had once defended him were aghast. "It was really horrifying," recalls Ruth Hovell, the Sunday school teacher. "We were all stunned." The man who had prosecuted Danny back in 1976, Bob Odom, was working in his yard when he saw a familiar figure walking toward him. It was the one-time minister from First Presbyterian, Wilson Keenan. He just came over and said how very sorry he was and how wrong he had been, Odom recalls. Becky Exley, now at graduate school in Austin, heard the news from her mother. She called and said someone from Temple had been arrested for this thing down in College Station, and she just knew it had to be Danny, Becky recalls. "I thought, No. Oh, shit, it can't be. When she learned of the 3 unsolved murders, her mind raced. Where had she been each time? Had she done things during their faltering relationship that set him off? She made a timeline, and finally decided she hadn't. Justice was swift. Danny didn't bother putting up a legal fight. He hired a local lawyer, pled guilty to the attack on Wendy Gaunt, and barely 3 months after his arrest, accepted a 99-year sentence. And for the moment, that was it. Even though investigators were now certain it was Danny who had murdered Deborah Ewing, it was the one victim he could be firmly tied to, there was little more to be done. Without a witness or some kind of physical evidence, there was no way to prove it. And nothing but speculation linked him to the death of Alice Martin. The only way the 3 murders would be solved, most agreed, was if Danny confessed. There was a Texas Ranger named Ed Richards, Frank Hidalgo told me. He said Danny's going to wake up one morning and something's going to flick his switch. Whether the guilt bothers him, believe it or not, these guys still have a lot of guilt, and he's just going to confess. On Thursday, March 23rd, 1989, a man named Lou Davis sat down with his morning coffee and flipped through the files, jackets they were called, of the 15 or so inmates he would be seeing that day at the Gorey Unit, 4 miles south of Huntsville. Davis was a gregarious former Marine in his early 40s with thinning hair, a midlife bulge, and a fading USMC tattoo on his right forearm. His job was to debrief incoming inmates, gathering any information that might help the guards: gang affiliations, family relationships, work, and criminal histories. Of the jackets he scanned, the most interesting by far was that of Daniel Lee Corwin, 31, convicted of a nasty rape in College Station, but, according to newspaper clippings in the file, suspected in 3 unsolved murders. His interest piqued, Davis put Corwin's jacket aside to handle once the others were dealt with. Danny, who had entered Gorey 8 days before, finally walked into Davis's office at the end of the day. Lou Davis took pride in his ability to talk with inmates. If he suspected one was gay, he would soften the tone of his questions. If he was a hard case, Davis might demand to be called Mr. Davis. He had once drawn a gang tattoo on his ankle to try and facilitate conversation with an incoming gang member. Danny was sullen and quiet. Davis rattled through all of the usual questions before guiding the conversation toward what interested him. He decided to spring the first question without warning. "So," Davis said suddenly, "what about the Vision Center? Well, that was you, wasn't it?" Danny lowered his head. "Don't know what you're talking about," he mumbled. "No?" "Uh-uh." Davis studied Danny closely. He hadn't yet adapted to his new realities. He looked broken, vulnerable. Davis tried variations on the same question. To each, Danny dropped his head and mumbled, "I wasn't there," or "I didn't do it." Still, something about Danny's manner emboldened Lou Davis. It was then he sprang the question that changed everything. Davis mentioned Mary Risinger. "What in the world were you and the woman at the car wash fighting about?" he asked. Again, Danny dropped his head. "I don't know," he said. Davis almost did a double take. "I don't know?" He was stunned. "I don't know." It wasn't an admission of guilt, but it wasn't another mumbled denial either. "Did she do something to make you mad?" "No." Davis asked whether Mary had been wearing something sexy or provocative. "No." "Did you stab her?" There was a heavy silence. Danny said his memory was hazy and like looking through a fog. Then he said, "I remember seeing her lying there with blood all over the place." Davis switched back to ask about Deborah Ewing. "You were there at the Vision Center, weren't you?" "Yes," Danny said. Did you kill that lady at the Vision Center? Yes. Stunned, Davis realized he needed a policeman. He knew one, a student in a Sunday school class he taught, was A.P. Merrillat, then a Huntsville police detective. He asked if Danny would agree to meet with him. "He's a good Christian man who won't jerk your chain or mess you around," Davis said. "Would you like to talk to him?" Danny indicated he wouldn't mind. Merrillat, one of the sharpest lawmen in the area, arrived at Gorey early that evening to find a group of prosecutors and detectives already milling around Davis's office. After a justice of the peace walked into an adjoining room to read Danny his rights, Merrillat repeated the act. Then he put down his papers and told Danny he was certain he had killed Deborah Ewing. "Now you don't see me jumping up and down and screaming and threatening you, do you?" he said. "But there are people who deserve to know what happened to their loved ones. You need to get this right." Danny grew quiet. He appeared to be crying. On any subject but the killings, Danny spoke normally. But the moment Merrillat brought one up, he hung his head and mumbled that he wasn't denying it. He just couldn't remember. They spoke for an hour like this until Danny asked for a lawyer. At that point, Merrillat stopped his questioning. Before leaving, he asked Danny if he could see him the following week. Danny said, sure. On Monday, a task force of officers involved in all three unsolved killings convened at Sam Houston State in Huntsville. Afterward, Merrillat got permission to take Danny, who hadn't sought out a lawyer after all, from Gorey to the Walker County Jail, where they could talk quietly. It was a tedious process. Danny, while not denying anything, insisted he couldn't remember much of anything. All he knew, he said, was at times he felt pressure in his head. When it happened, people got hurt. Finally, after several days of this, Danny quit talking altogether. Merrillat, keeping his manner calm and supportive, asked if visiting the crime scenes might help. Danny mumbled his acquiescence. Together they drove to the Vision Center, then to the sites where each of the three bodies had been found. It worked. At the car wash, Danny walked Merrillat through what he remembered of the struggle with Mary Rissinger. In Montgomery County, he admitted the attack on Deborah Ewing. It took several more days before he would acknowledge he killed Alice Martin. He gave few details, but afterward signed a bare-bones confession. It was enough. In a final effort to get more, a deputy approached Becky Exley in Austin, leaving his card in her apartment door. She soon found herself on a private jet en route to Huntsville, where she was taken to the jail. It was a heartbreaking moment. This was the man Becky had dreamed of marrying. "Danny is let in," she recalls. "I hug him. We talked about school. I told him how sorry I was, how he just wasn't meant to be a husband at the time. I urged him to come clean. I just told him, tell them whatever they need. Give the families closure. Then I hugged him and said goodbye. It was the last time I ever saw him." News of Danny's confessions finally forced his parents to come to terms with what their son had done. "You keep searching for an answer, asking, what the hell went wrong?" Phil Corwin told the Houston Chronicle. "You go through self-reproach. You go through guilt. You wonder what you did. You wonder what you didn't do. You keep asking yourself, searching for an answer, and in Dan's case, you keep coming to a dead end." A year after his confessions to A.P. Merrillat in March 1990, Danny went on trial in a state courtroom in Conroe. He was the first person indicted in Texas under a new law that allowed a serial killer to be tried for all his murders at once. It was the first time most of the families were able to see Danny in person. "I wouldn't have believed it," Mary Rissinger's sister, Sarah Berger, tells me. "He was so scrawny." "He didn't look like a serial killer," her husband, Phil, interjects. "He was just so quiet," Sarah says, "so meek." The proceedings themselves were almost anticlimactic. Danny didn't testify. As others did, he hung his head, refusing to make eye contact with anyone. Alice Martin's husband, Alvin, cried on the stand. Deborah Ewing's father lost his temper at one point, shouting that he wanted to cut Danny's throat. The jurors took all of 2.5 hours to return the guilty verdict. During the punishment phase, Danny's surviving victims, Kathy Choate, Brenda Evans, and Wendy Gaunt, narrated chilling versions of what he had done to them. I remember when Brenda and Wendy testified, there was just dead silence in the courtroom, Frank Hidalgo told me. When the jury saw the photos of the cuts on their throats, they looked straight at Danny and you could see the anger in their eyes. Danny's mother Nancy and sister Debbie testified on his behalf, describing him as a caring son. In an attempt to suggest he might have suffered from some kind of brain damage, both women related episodes when Danny was very young, where he took blows to the head, an abrupt stop in the family car, and an incident when a cousin accidentally hit him with a croquet mallet. I would never have believed he could do anything like this, Nan said, wiping away tears. It's just beyond imagination. The jury took 25 minutes to sentence Danny to death by lethal injection. Afterward, Deborah Ewing's father told reporters he wished Texas still used the electric chair. I feel better about it, but I'd still like to be the one to pull the switch, he said. The needle's not good enough for him. Danny's trial, while bringing justice to those who had lost loved ones, didn't satisfy the families. Because he hadn't testified, they had little sense what had actually happened to Alice Martin, Deborah Ewing, and Mary Rissinger. Mary's sister Sarah was especially upset. Even before the trial ended, she began pestering prison officials to let her talk to Danny. It took 7 years, during which Danny remained on Huntsville's death row as his appeals dragged on. Finally, on September 27, 1997, after attending a series of mediation classes, Sarah and Alice Martin's granddaughter, Sabrina Ehrenreich, were ushered into a small room at the Ellis 1 unit. They took seats before a window. Danny was already sitting on the other side. He had agreed to the meeting, saying he wanted to make amends. Appearing doughy and pale, wearing a white prison tunic and lightly tinted aviator glasses, Danny was nearly 40 that day. Clean-shaven and perfectly groomed, his blonde hair now feathered a bit, he could have passed for a small-town insurance agent. In one corner, a camera had been set up. A recording begins with Danny already describing his childhood. His biographical recitation lasts maybe 15 minutes. His eyes are dead, his face expressionless. Danny mentions the attacks on Kathy Choate and Brenda Evans in passing. Then, in his first effort at deflecting responsibility, brings up the doctors at Ferguson. The court ordered me to receive treatment at the time, but that did not happen, he says. The doctors loaded me with medicine, then put me in general population. I expected more. Since it didn't, I thought it's going to be up to me. He describes his time at Ferguson as a self-improvement campaign, taking classes, attending church. I thought I could defeat whatever it was inside me that caused me to commit the crimes in the first place. I was trying to straighten myself out. Afterward, Danny says he never trusted psychologists. I think part of it was the experience I had when I first went to prison, he says. The doctors didn't really care. When I approached the psychologists, their response was to increase the dosage of the medication they were giving me. Danny makes a little face. I learned to be quiet after that, he says. He speaks of the attacks on Alice Martin and Mary Rissinger, but only in the most glancing ways. Of the attack on Alice, he says, I liked to drive in the country, spent time sightseeing. During one of those drives, I came upon a woman. I can't say why I stopped, why I picked her up, why I forced her to come with me and drive off and raped her. He remembers talking to Alice during the 20-minute drive. I cannot recall the words, he says. Everything becomes like a dreamlike state. Of Mary Rissinger, Danny has little more to say. I remember pulling into the car wash, he begins. I wasn't aware of anyone there at the time. I started washing the truck, then ran out of change and went to the change machine to get more. It was only then, Danny claims, that he was aware a woman was in the next bay. In the written confession he had given A.P. Marillat, he remembered leaning against the change machine for several minutes as a sexual feeling overcame him. I approached her to abduct her, Danny says on the tape, to take her away from there. I know we struggled very much. He recalls pulling his knife. Mary Rissinger saw it and fought him. During the struggle, she was cut. I do not remember exactly how, other than the struggle continuing. I know she was cut more after that. I did not know Kristen was there at first. It wasn't until sometime during the struggle that I knew she was even there. When I left, or started to leave, she had followed me, crying. But I quickly got in my truck and drove away. After Danny finishes, Sarah and Sabrina spend the next 3 hours alternately asking him questions and sharing their own memories, determined to show him the consequences of his crimes. Sabrina actually makes him watch a section of her wedding video. When she seeks more details of the attack on her grandmother, Danny says he must have repressed them. Time and again, the two women press him to explain the forces that drove him. Time and again, Danny insists he has no clue. The question that everyone wants answered is why, he says at one point, and I wish I knew. I come up with all sorts of ideas. They never seem to be adequate enough. I have more frustrations about this than anything else. It's just a question I wish I could answer. I keep trying. So far, no luck. In the 1990 Houston Chronicle article, a psychologist named Joel Norris said that he had interviewed Danny, who had admitted to having sex with animals, and who said he was driven by violent sexual fantasies. When he was paroled, he was still having the same violent sexual fantasies he'd had since he was 14. He still has them today. On the tape, Sabrina gives Danny a chance to talk about this. He ducks the question. Instead, Danny appears to suggest that the killings were brought on by the stress of leaving his parents in Temple and beginning a life of his own. In Madisonville and later in Huntsville, Danny said, I was still unsure of myself. I thought, okay, I'm moving on with life. Let's go. Of course, this was a time of a lot of stress, dealing with life in college and supporting myself. Norris, who has since died, believed that these stresses caused Danny to become ever more dependent on Becky Exley and that the killings were a way of him acting out as their relationship began to disintegrate. He started showing symptoms of coming unglued before the killing spree started, Norris argued. He became as dependent on a girlfriend as he had been with his mother. It seems that every time one of these attacks happened, there had been some sort of major disagreement with a girlfriend. Becky Exley rejects this line of thinking entirely. There were obvious problems with Danny's insistence that he had no idea why he killed. Sarah and Sabrina, who were not professional interviewers, never pressed him about this contradiction. But watching that tape as it advanced hour after hour, I studied Danny closely. He was lying. I knew it. It wasn't just that he had a weird verbal tic. He never said the words can't or don't. It was always cannot and do not. Language experts say a refusal to use contractions can be a tip-off that someone is lying. But that wasn't why I was certain. It was Danny's story about being raped himself as a teen. On the tape, he brings it up. Not once, but twice. He clearly wants Sabrina and Sarah to believe this attack had somehow warped him into becoming a serial killer. Crucially, Danny told the two women he had been raped before his attacks on Kathy Choate and Brenda Evans. I knew from his police files that it had happened at the Bell County Jail in 1975, after the attack on Brenda. Mentioning it seemed a naked plea for sympathy. And if Danny was lying about that, I believed, he was lying about everything. I think he knew exactly why he killed, to satisfy his fantasies. And I don't think those fantasies had anything to do with Becky Exley or the stress of adult life. I think Danny waited years to resume attacking and raping women, and the moment he wriggled free of his family's embrace in Temple, he struck, killing Alice Martin. But Danny would not admit any of this, either because he was too ashamed or because it didn't serve his own aims. Why would he agree to meet with Sabrina and Sarah and admit to a series of gruesome murders, but then refuse to explain his motives? A cynic might conclude he was just a sadist who enjoyed watching their pain. But I believe Danny wanted not just their approval, but also their forgiveness. It's what he had sought his entire life. Near the end of the interview, Sabrina asks if there is anything he wanted to add to what had been said. "I wish that I could very much turn back time," Danny replies. "It's taken me a long time to deal, to allow myself to feel emotions and feelings that you all might have faced. I just wish there was more that I could do. Now." Danny desperately needed these two grieving women to believe he had turned a new leaf, that he was reformed. I have to admit, until that point, there had been a part of me that believed Danny was somehow a victim in all this himself, that his inability to get help, to get psychiatrist treatment, somehow reduced his responsibility for all that had happened. In his lies, I saw the truth. This was all a con job. I was put in mind of something Danny had said in his taped interview. At one point, Sabrina had asked him where he expected to go after his death. He had replied very simply, without a trace of irony, "I hope to go to heaven. I have doubts." Members of the families began gathering at Huntsville's Holiday Inn a little after 5 that day, December 7th, 1998. A bit later, they were brought to the walls. Inside, in the corner of a courtyard, was the death house, a surprisingly small building that one writer has compared to a garden shed. After waiting in an anteroom, the families were led down a long corridor and crowded into a tiny room the size of a walk-in closet. On one end was a window covered by a curtain. Behind it was the execution chamber itself, which resembles a doctor's examination room. For his last meal, Danny ate steak and potatoes and drank a root beer. Afterward, at 6:05, he was led into the execution chamber and guided onto a gurney, where a thick leather belt was strapped across his chest. At 6:11, an intravenous line was inserted into his right arm. At 6:18, another was threaded into his left hand. A sheet was draped over his body and his arms extended, a pose that some have compared to that of a crucifixion. His hands were wrapped with ACE bandages. At 6:20, the curtain parted, and the families could finally see him. The warden, standing to one side in a suit, asked Danny if he had any last words. Danny nodded and said he did. It was an odd, rambling statement. Danny didn't mention his parents or his family, who had chosen not to attend. Instead, he addressed two very special people, Sarah Berger and Sabrina Ehrenreich, thanking them for affording me the opportunity that y'all did. "It made a real difference in my life. I thank you. Thank you again from the deepest part of my heart. I regret what happened, and I want you to know that I'm sorry. I just ask and hope that sometime down the line that you can forgive me. I think without that it becomes very empty and hollow, and the only thing we have is hatred and anger." He concluded by thanking the women yet again. "It meant so much. Thank you so much for being with me and my family. Thank you. I love you." At 6:26, his statement concluded, chemicals were released into the intravenous lines. Danny made no sound as he died. He simply closed his eyes, once and for all. 7 minutes later, as the families watched in silence, a doctor entered and checked his vital signs. The warden noted the time of death, 6:33. Someone let out a little cheer. After 30 minutes, it was over. Even then, Sarah Berger told me, many in the families weren't satisfied. It was too easy, she says. Think about what he put my sister through, how she suffered. Too easy. Today, 20 years after his execution, the world has forgotten Danny Corwin. Google him today and you find exactly one webpage called Murderpedia with information about his crimes. It's so interesting that in a town of 40,000 people, it's like it never happened, marvels Becky Exley. This could be something featured on Unsolved Mysteries or a TV show, you know? And it's not. How did 40,000 people not come together and blow this sky high? It all just kind of went away. Memory is a funny thing. If it's too painful, it gets pushed away, buried. Towns do that too. Even today, many in Temple won't talk about Danny. Most cite a desire not to hurt the Corwin family. Danny's father has died, but his mother and siblings are still alive. They declined to respond to a letter I sent. When I tracked down Danny's one-time roommate, Patrick Fuller, he too begged off, saying he didn't want to drag the Corwins through the mud. I found Brenda Evans, Kathy Choate, and Wendy Gaunt living under their married names. None wished to talk to me. I felt bad for asking the victims to share the memories of their horrific encounters with Danny Corwin, but I understood. Memories can wound, but they can also help us learn and heal. I felt good that, in a small way, talking about Danny had proved helpful for a few. Becky Exley said she found it cathartic. She and her husband decided to tell their adult children about Danny. Our talk with the kids went great, Becky emailed me afterward. Funny how when we worry about things, they seem to turn out better than we could have imagined, and the worry was a waste of time. Little Kristen Rissinger, who survived her mother's murder, grew up to be a mother of three. I asked her aunt, Sarah Berger, what Kristen understood about all that happened 30 years ago. Funny, Sarah told me. I called to tell her about this story, and she said, Aunt Sarah, I've been trying to research this and find out things. She said, I blocked so much out. There are some things I'm beginning to remember. I think she is trying to remember. Suddenly, I thought of Dusty Dolger, the deputy who had found Kristen in her blood-soaked ballerina costume. I sent along his best, as he'd asked. That made me feel better. A little. Kristen died last year in a car accident. Looking back today, it's easy to say that Danny had demons. But what kind? Did he really hear voices? Did he really see things? Was he, as the doctor said when he was 16, a schizophrenic? The fact is, no one knew. And worse, despite all the warning signs, no one ever looked that hard. After that initial assessment when he first went to prison, doctors left him alone. The counselor he saw in Temple was far more interested in his post-prison transition than what sent him there in the first place. Phil Corwin later told a counselor that the psychologists Danny saw as a teenager insisted he would never hurt anyone again. And the Corwins believed it, because they desperately wanted to. They never got Danny the help he needed, because they didn't want to believe he needed it. Like many serial killers, Danny appears to have been driven by violent fantasies. Yet, as far as anyone knows, in his 30 years of life, he offered precisely one glimpse of what those fantasies were. It happened in 1981, when Danny was still at Ferguson. His auto mechanics instructor, Mark Lenorman, asked him to draw him something he could use to decorate his house for Halloween. Danny produced a 6-foot-high, full-color painting of a demon, a green and yellowish serpentine figure. In one hand, the creature held a scalp, dripping with blood. In the other, a bloody hatchet and a detached human arm. Lenormand hung it on his front door.
This has been an Audible Originals production of The Demon Next Door, written by Brian Burrow, performed by Steve White. Executive producers David Blum, Keith O'Connell, and Mike Charzik. Editorial producer Doug Stumpf. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2019 by Brian Burrow. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.